Sometimes, to appreciate where you are, you have to go back to how it all began. In life, there is undoubtedly some obstacle, some struggle, some lack of faith you had to overcome before you could get to where you are today. Make no mistake, there is always a tale of courage, hope, or inspiration, or maybe all three, which others can learn from, or from which we can empathize. We can all grow from the experience of learning from what you have to share. Everyone has a story. Mark Brodinski, The Sunday Series.
Pull the trigger, just go. An object at rest stays at rest. An object in motion continues and stays in motion. And I found that one of the hardest things to do with anything is just start, right? And just go. From writing a blog post to recording podcast episodes to writing in the morning with my book. Once I get going, then I'm in motion. And I want to give a big shout out to Zephan over here. Is Zephan in the crowd? Where's Zephan at? Awesome. So Zephan came up to me yesterday after the awards show, and he told me that we had exchanged emails in 2013. I went back to my hotel room and I read what he had wrote to his fans, and I want to read that for you here. So he said, "When I left my job, one of the first people I messaged was Pat Flynn. I'd been following him for years. In May of 2013, he wrote to me and said, 'A lot of people go into something and stick with it, only to realize it's not what they should have done in the first place. For me, it took getting laid off to realize that,' that's me talking, 'a huge blessing in disguise. For you, you discover that early on your own. And although things are scary, exciting, ecstatic, and confusing all at the same time right now, your older self will look back on this time of your life and thank you for it.' And then he followed up with, 'Well, I'm older now, and looking back, I don't regret it one bit. I got to thank him in person, and I'm grateful.' So thank you, Zephan, for pulling the trigger and sharing that with me. That means the world. Thank you. Great job on pulling the trigger. And you never know what's going to be on the other end, but at least he gave it a shot. And now he's doing some incredible. What shows are you working on now with your video production crew? Did you say House of Cards? He's been in the White House, NFL, NHL. He's worked on House of Cards as a result of him starting his own work. Congratulations.
My name is John Knipp, and I'm the creator and founder of Avenues Audio, and you're listening to the Year of Purpose podcast with Zephan Moses Blacksburg. I met Zephan a few years ago when he was starting his journey, and after watching him interview over 150 people around the world, publishing a number one best-selling book and completely transforming his life, I decided it was time we share his story. Welcome to the last podcast. This is your last podcast, correct?
I would say that this is the last episode for the Year of Purpose podcast, but I don't think that I'm just, this isn't like in a movie where, you know, cinematically I buy my one-way plane ticket and just go disappear right off into, Southeast Asia or something
right.
Like, I don't think podcasting is over for me, but certainly my intention with this was after hearing the last lecture by Randy Pausch, you know, really thinking like, what is my message if I were to not be here tomorrow?
Right.
Because as much as, you know, I'm only 27, that's very far off into the future. But, you know, for many people, they don't get the chance to live that long. And you never really know. Like, tomorrow could be the last day. And so for me personally, I felt that after, you know, talking to over 150 people from Los Angeles to Southeast Asia, like, it only made sense both for my audience, but for the audience to come in the future, you know, anyone else to find this in the future, almost like a time capsule in a sense to say, like, here's what I wanted to leave behind in the world.
Right.
And, you know, we even had this conversation before we started recording was like, a lot of people have asked me when they interview me on podcasts, you know, what is your purpose? Did you find it? And I think that we make this mistake by thinking your purpose is just one statement. I look at my purpose as being kind of like this cause and effect relationship. I am the cause, and whatever effect, whatever ripple it has on the world, on you, on your friends, anyone who's listened to the show, or maybe anyone who hasn't listened to the show, I think that is my purpose, is, you know, the effect it's had to inspire others or to even demotivate others. Maybe it's demotivating. I don't really know. But the point is that my purpose, I don't think, can be summed up in just a one-liner. I think that my purpose is kind of what has happened from here on out, almost like the butterfly effect, because I took a leap of faith, because I took a risk, and because I put myself out there. And, you know, I doubt that anyone's path would have gone the same way, you know, had I not done this. So for me, it was really just this exploration into, you know, it was this exploration into why am I here? But it was also this exploration into how can I leave behind, you know, the biggest dent in the universe? How can I leave behind the biggest change as a result of my being here? And if tomorrow were my last day, you know, being able to sum it up in this podcast episode was just so important to me, because it's essentially a time capsule. Mm-hmm. You know, it will be here now. It will be here 10 years from now. It'll be here long after I'm gone.
Right. Right.
And so that's really why I like this medium. You know, this audio recording could last forever, essentially.
Yeah, right. Let's start from the beginning. Let's take it back right out of college. Who were you? What were you doing? What was going on?
So, I mean, I went to college at James Madison University, and I think that a lot of what I did, both in college, out of college, after that point, is actually a mirror image of how I was born. So it's worth mentioning that when I was born, you know, my mom was getting ready to go to the gym. She went to the bathroom and my feet popped out in the toilet. And as most people know, babies usually are supposed to pop out head first. And on top of that, when I was being delivered by the volunteer fire department, I had the umbilical cord wrapped around my neck 3 times. And I was not breathing.
You were delivered by the volunteer fire department?
The volunteer fire department.
What?
And the funniest thing is one of the medic that actually saved my life became my school bus driver like 10, 15 years later when I was in middle school.
Wow.
So,
wow.
And we had no idea until one day we found out that he was there and he remembered who I was because he remembered delivering me.
Yeah, that's like a Forrest Gump moment, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, so it just, I think that has been kind of like a mirror for me of like, it was never my choice, you know, to necessarily exist in this world. Like, I think I remember back to like our philosophy classes in college is like, you are thrust into existence. Like you right. never sat there and said, hey, I wonder if I'm going to become a human being. Like right. it happens.
Right.
And so I think that many times, you know, we're put into circumstances that can be quite complicated and somewhat suffocating in
right.
a sense.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, it's up to other people to, you know, give a helping hand and do as much as they can do. But then it's really on us, you know, so like they resuscitated me. But then after that, it was up to me to start breathing on my own to actually make it happen.
Right.
And so when I look at college and what happened there, we have this fantastic experience. Just if I could put my life out on a wall, this is one of the bigger pictures that stands out, was that my fraternity brother, who was a freshman in college, had gone home for winter break. And unfortunately, like a couple of days, I don't know if it was like the day he went home or a couple of days into his break, his mom just didn't wake up one morning.
Wow.
And, you know, I remember him coming back to school and writing this whole letter to the fraternity of, you know, I need your support now more than ever. Yeah. You know, I just lost my mom. And it was totally uncalled for. You know, they had no clue it was going to happen. There was
right.
no warning sign. It just right. happened.
Wow.
And he was a writer. He was actually going into the same digital video and cinema program that I was in. And his way of coping with the loss was he started to write out his story as it was unfolding of him, you know, from the experience of like going home for break up through becoming infatuated with someone who he went to school with, kind of as a distraction to
right.
get away from the stress of life and what was going on. And at some point, you know, months later, he had shared with me this script and was like, you know, he looked up to me because I was further along in the program and wanted to get my opinion. And he sent it to me and was like, what do you think of this? Like, could I become a writer? And I read it, and I'm not the best writer myself. Like, let's get it straight. My grammar is terrible. But I read it, and I was like, you don't understand. Like, this is like a movie.
Yeah.
And when I told him that, something just kind of clicked for me. And I've always been one to challenge and push further, and very much how when I was born, you know, you're given this struggle, and then it's totally up to you to see how far you want to take it.
Right.
I decided that it should become a movie, and then he didn't quite believe it at first because he didn't truly believe in his own work. You know, he just thought, and we do this a lot to ourselves.
Yeah.
But I convinced him. I was like, hey, man, I really think we could turn this into something. And next thing you know, because I feel like I just like blacked out everything in between, we're going around to professors all through the department to try and get course credit as an independent course to make this a feature film.
Wow.
And I just remember I like picked out my team. I sat in the editing lab, watched who I wanted to pick, picked out my guy. I asked him if he was in. He was in. I picked out my guy who I wanted to run camera. I asked him if he was in. He was in. And I had my team. It was the four of us. We're going around professor to professor because we have to get someone to sign off as like the teacher of our class to give us course credit. And everyone was like, there's no way. Like, you don't have the funding. You don't have the equipment to pull this off.
Right,
like,
right.
You know, it's just not possible. And essentially every professor kind of laughed us out of their offices until I got to the last professor to ask. And we walk into his office and he's like, I'll sign off on this under one condition. And you turn this into like a 10-minute short. And we're just like, you don't understand. Like, did you read the script? Like, this is not a story that can be told in 10 minutes. Like, it deserves a full feature length. And he was like, you got to make it into a short. Like, try for like 20, 30 minutes max. But there's still, I don't see how you guys are going to pull it off. And at this point, I remember, I think I like got up on a chair or something. And I was like, look, here's the deal. I'm supposed to graduate a year early. Like, I had been busting my butt to stay every summer and get these credits so I could graduate early, take some of the burden off of the tuition fees. And I was like, I'm supposed to get out of here a year early.
Right.
And here's the deal. If I don't pull this off, you can fail me and I will come back and, you know, take your class again. And it will be the only class that I have, you know, next year just to graduate because
wow.
I only need 3 credits and you can make it as miserable as you want for
wow.
me.
Wow. Wow.
And I think that was kind of like the point of like, hey, you know, here's your struggle.
Yeah.
How far do you want to take it? And so I think that this was really kind of like the turning point for me just in my life and taking things further and further to see how far you could push that limit. And sure enough, in 2010, from beginning of that year, you know, we revised the script. We did a full casting call with the theater department. We got our actors. We actually raised $1,000 budget between asking local businesses for money. We actually got a $25 gift card from Walmart out of all places, which like was the worst place to ask. They were so pissed off about it, but they did it anyway. And
what were they pissed off about?
I think that like just they saw us as a bunch of college kids and they weren't going to take us seriously and they didn't really understand why we were doing this,
huh. You
know, but our heart was in it because we truly knew, you know, we were pushing it to the limit. We wanted to do something that students in this program at this school had never done before. You know, we wanted to do something different.
Right.
And so, I mean, that summer, I remember I worked a little bit, but for the most part, we let our actors go home and then they came back for the summer. You know, they were basically crashing in my apartment. I was buying them pizzas out of my own pocket. And I've
with the Walmart gift cards.
Yeah, of course. Right. And I've got like videos of us just hanging around. I actually remember very specifically, we took the main two actors, the male and the female lead,
yeah. And
we had them switch lines just for, you know, we were probably yeah. Hanging out and drinking too much or something, but we had them switch lines and it was hysterical because the male lead started changing what the lines actually were. And then she would come in and be like, that's not my line. And he's like, I know, just go with it. Just go with it.
Right.
And
right.
It was hysterical. I mean, we had a blast. And that whole summer we filmed into the fall, we started editing. We had local bands donate their music for our soundtrack.
Wow, cool.
You know, and went through and color graded the whole thing. I was self-taught on color correction. And I remember editing until 3-4 o'clock in the morning. They gave us this little closet in the basement that had an editing suite in it, and it was ours. We had a private key to get in.
Oh, cool.
And we just lived out of that room. And finally, in December of 2010, we premiered a feature length, a 96 minute long film.
Wow.
Out of, you know, this script that just, it was the story of this guy's life. And so I think, you know, it was unbelievable leaving college because we had pulled something off that no one else had pulled off up right. until that point. And so that really became the theme for me. You know, I leave college, I've got to find a job. But, you know, in the back of my mind, being this mindset of we're going to Sundance and we're going to do all this stuff, I was like, I'm going to just get a plane ticket and go to California. Right. Like,
yeah.
I'll walk across the stage at graduation. I don't even care to get the diploma. Like, I was done. I was over it. Like,
right.
I just wanted to go to California and live out my dream. And next thing you know, I wasn't going to California. I was afraid. I was in a relationship at the time. I had no clue. It went from, you know, like premiere and this high.
Right. I was going to say.
And then, you know, like a week or so after graduation, I'm like, where am I in the world?
Is it just the uncertainty of every graduate that, you know, the second you cross that stage, is that what was going on here?
I think part of it was the uncertainty, but part of it was also like this pressure of thinking I had to live out this story that everyone else did, you know, of go to college, get the degree, get the job, do the same thing for 40 years.
Right.
And hopefully you have a family and kids and retire and buy a house at some point. Like,
were you already mapping this timeline out in your head?
I don't think I had like specific dates of when I wanted things to happen, because I think a piece of my brain was like, hey, dude, you know, this is not what you want for yourself.
Right.
So I think that I was kind of fighting that urge of, you know, do I follow the script of what everyone else is doing?
Right.
Or do I do my own thing? And I think out of fear, I ultimately chose not to get that flight. And so here I am, you know, like 2 weeks out of school, just job searching. I think I sent out like 100 applications because it was still a pretty bad job market.
Yeah.
And I remembered being at the house of the person I was dating at the time, and I was on Craigslist just searching the job postings, and I see posting for a videographer nearby within like 10 minutes of home. Applied for it, got a phone call, got an interview the next day. And I remember like at the beginning of the interview, she's like, yeah, you know, we've got like 2 or 3 more people coming in that we want to interview. So, I mean, we're not making the decision just yet. And then at the end of the interview, she was like, I'm probably going to give you a call tomorrow. And I don't think I knew the weight of getting a job at this company. I don't think I understood what that was going to do for me and my career
right
from that point on.
Actually, 20-somethings and 30-somethings have been in before. When you have a job that on paper looks good to your friends and your parents and the people you meet at happy hour, but internally, when you wake up in the morning, you know something's not right. You know, and how did I know something wasn't right? Well, every time my alarm went off in the morning, I'd have that kind of that tingling sensation, right? That pain that goes up and down your back, that pain in your stomach when you brush your teeth, when you get dressed, when you put on your tie in the morning, when I rode the bus down to work, and I was like, it was really difficult for me.
And so, you know, I got hired at Glazer Kennedy Insider Circle. It was founded by Dan Kennedy and Bill Glazer, and essentially they're copywriters and just marketing masters. I mean, they had been helping business owners all over the globe.
Here in Baltimore, there's...
Yeah, they're located... So the office was located here in Baltimore, but they, you know, they worked globally, essentially. I mean,
right.
They had business owners all over the place that they were helping out.
Right.
And, you know, they ran big conferences that they flew me out to. I filmed... I essentially was their go-to video guy. So from filming conferences to a weekly web TV show up on YouTube, like, I remember the day we hit 100,000 views on our YouTube channel. And it was just like, I didn't, this was before YouTube stars and sensations were popular.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
this is 2010, 2011. Like,
yeah.
It wasn't a big deal back then to have 1 million views on your video.
Subscribers and all that stuff, right?
Yeah. And so for us, it was like, oh my God, like, I didn't know I could create this.
Right.
And it was right around that time I actually, you know, they were getting ready to sell the company, and things were kind of weird in the job because I didn't have as much of a role anymore, because the new supervisor that came in for me just like didn't give me any work to do. And so I remember kind of searching around. I discovered Pat Flynn, who, you know, you guys have probably heard in the intro to this episode. And I had started to learn about Smart Passive Income and his website and what he was doing and blogging for money. And I started a website called Rookie Video Pro. And the idea was to like teach rookie videographers how to become more professional or how to make your video look more professional. And I only ran it for like, I don't know, 3 or 6 months until I gave up on it because I just had no clue what I was doing. But there was this idea of, in my head of like, there's some sort of freedom in what you do. You don't have to just work this job 9 to 5.
Right.
For, you know, so like, I think there was a small piece of me that was kind of pushing me. Hey, dude, try something different. Come on. It's out there for you to grab.
Right.
And I wasn't quite ready yet. So I think I didn't, you know, end up doing that.
Right.
But yeah, that job lasted for about 1.5 years. The owner ultimately decided to sell a stake in the company. And the people who came in and bought us out a couple months later walked in one day with a lawyer and said, here's your pink slip.
Oh.
And I'm like, I did everything right. I got the degree. I got the job.
Right.
I even started, you know, 401k or, you know, all the retirement stuff. How did I fail? Like, I thought I did everything right.
Right.
And so I remember like sitting there the day I got fired, or let go, I guess. I wasn't fired. I did a great job. But I remember like going to get a drink and lunch afterwards because I had no clue what to do with myself.
Yeah, in shock.
Yeah, and like thinking that I did something wrong.
Right.
You know, because I thought like this is what you were supposed to do is you like work and do the same thing for the rest of your life.
So you were following protocol.
Yeah.
And that insecurity was gone while you were doing that, correct? When you were hired by that company, all those initial fears that you had after graduation dissipated, correct?
Yeah, I mean, I was getting a paycheck every 2 weeks.
Right.
Like, I thought that equated to, hey, you did it right. Like
at that time, were you projecting what you were going to do next? I know you mentioned the YouTube stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I had this idea in my head of like maybe I can make passive income.
Well, I mean, was California on the horizon at this point now? That now that you gained some confidence back, right? That you got hired and you're doing the video work.
Yeah.
Did you think, you know what? I could probably pull off California at this point. Or is that still not?
I think it had actually dissipated a little bit because I had been sucked into the job and just thought that things were going well. So like, I don't know that it came up in my mind. I mean, my first thoughts were go on unemployment, you know, get your paycheck still
and
freelance as much as you can because I had a camera.
Yeah.
And so I went into like survival mode. Like I wasn't even thinking into the future. I was like, how am I going to have enough money at the end of the week?
Right.
Mind you, I'm still living at home, like under my parents' roof. It's not even like I was going to be out on the street. Like it wasn't an issue. But in my head, I had this thinking of like, I completely failed. Like I am going to end up on the street because I did everything right. And at some point I messed it up and I failed.
That's what, but they gave you the pink slip and you assumed that that was because of personal failure, not because of, we just can't afford to do this anymore because the market is down. We can't afford to pay someone with your skill set to only do that for our company. Is that, I mean, like, is there a reason why you took on that as a failure, you know, so much weight on your shoulders, as opposed to saying, you know what, I know I did a great job. Here's my work to prove it. You just can't afford me.
I think the problem was I didn't know why I was let go.
Okay.
Like they literally just said, you know, we need you to sign this paper. You don't have to sign it today. You can think it over.
And this was out of the blue. You just won't.
Oh, yeah. I mean, like we saw them in the parking lot, like walking in, and we knew people were kind of one by one being called down from their offices. So we had an inkling because like someone came in, I forget who it was, but, you know, and gave me a hug and was like, sorry, guys, like they let me go. You know, I loved working with you guys, but I'm out. And so there was, you know, everybody was kind of quiet and word was going around, but we didn't know who and how many were getting let go because not everyone got let go that day.
Yeah.
So we had no idea what was going to happen, but.
So you're at home, you're in survival mode. What happened?
So I started doing what I could with what I had. I just went back to basics. Okay. You know, I've got a camera and I've got these skills and I met a lot of people through this company, some of them local, and started reaching out to a few of the local people and freelanced a little bit for about 3 or 4 months. You know, it was just enough money combined with my unemployment that I was fine. I think I remember at one point in time having like my midlife crisis really early and just deciding to put my unemployment check towards taking the motorcycle license class.
Right.
So this was like Memorial Day weekend. And like,
that's usually at 30, 35.
Right. And imagine me, I guess, let's see, this was
40 now.
2012. So yeah. I was probably like 22. And imagine
not
me,
even a quarter life crisis yet.
Right. Unemployed, walking out of my room to my Jewish mother and saying, "Hey, mom, I'm going to get my motorcycle license. You can't do anything."
Oh boy. That's
and you know, praying that I could come home to a bed later that night. But yeah, I mean, I just kind of had this point of like, I don't know where I am in life. And you know, I was always told that like people who are in crisis and have no clue what they're doing, just go and get a motorcycle. So let's just do that.
right. It's fairly inexpensive, actually.
They're actually pretty cheap. And that's why for me, I was also too at the time. I'm like, well, maybe I could save some money, get a motorcycle and not spend as much on gas. And who knows? But I was like, I don't know, maybe 3 or 4 months on unemployment, had done a couple projects for a local guy who ran a real estate school. And, you know, he paid me here and there. And I'll never forget that.
Videography projects for the. Okay, gotcha.
Yeah. But I'll never forget at the end of each shoot, he would say, you know, how much do I owe you? And I like had no clue how to price my stuff at that time. So a 3-4 hour shoot, I'd say like $200.
Right.
But I found that no matter what I said, he'd always add $50 to it. And I think this was where one of my first business lessons came in subconsciously, was that no matter whether I said $150, $200, $250, he always added $50 to it. And I didn't quite get it yet. You know, it didn't click. I was just like, oh man, got an extra $50. Sweet.
Yeah.
But I think that like it's really important to note that like there was a lesson that came in being unemployed and being a freelancer, you know, part time, in how this one client was treating me, because I was giving him the utmost respect. I was giving him the highest quality work that I could with what I had, you know, and I was always available and on time and things like that. So this lesson, I'm sure, plays out later down the road. But I freelanced for about 3 or 4 months, and I had totally forgotten, because I had been throwing out applications left and right, just applying everywhere. And I had applied to work at the Apple store. And one night, I'm out with my friends, driving, like 3 or 4 other people are in my car, music's really loud, people are, you know, loud and noisy, and I get a phone call. And I had no clue who it was from, but I, you know, knew that some of my job applications were out there. So I figured, okay, let's answer this. I'm like quieting everyone down in the car, like, shut up. And I answer the phone. Hey, this is Jason, one of the managers at the Apple store here. And I'm like, oh, hi.
Right,
and I'm in the car, like, yeah, on the way to, you know, yeah, bar with my friends or something. And just like, guys, shut up.
right.
And I'm like,
Steve Jobs is on the phone.
Right. And I'm like, what's going on? And he's like, yeah, you know, I just wanted to call and invite you to an interview at the Apple store, because, you know, we got your resume and your application, and we'd love to have you in. And, you know, it was like, are you available on such and such date and time? We do like this group interview thing.
Awesome.
Like, yeah, sure. Totally.
Yeah.
And, you know, showed up for that. Went through this first round where like they bring you into the store after it's closed at night. There's like 40, 50 other people in there. So you have no clue how many people you're up against. You have no idea how many positions are open, and, you know, go through this interview round, and they do kind of like a round table. So like, I'm trying to figure out if I need to sound better than this guy next to me in my answers, or if like they don't want a smart Alex. So if I need to dumb it down, like I had no clue what to do. So I just kind of kept it in the middle.
Right.
And sure enough, like a week later, they give me a call back. They're like, hey, we want to bring you in for another interview. And this time it was, I came back into the Apple store, but it was much smaller. Like those 40 or 50 people are not, it's down to like, I think like 3 or 4 groups of 3. So they're down to like, you know, 10 or 12 people. And I'm just like, oh my God, like I made it through that, but I don't know if I'll make it through this. And sure enough, made it through that and got a call back for one final interview. They said, you know, we've got this meeting with one of our regional managers and also with the store manager here. Just kind of like a final precaution. We just want to get to know you a little bit more and really, you know, make sure that we have the right person.
Right.
And I'm like, cool, awesome. And I'm ecstatic. Like, I made it through 3 rounds. At this point in time, Apple was still known for being harder to get into than Harvard University. So
right.
I'm like, oh my God, like, it was great. And I loved Apple. I've always been an Apple fanboy ever since I got my first Mac computer. So I just always loved Apple.
Apple plug.
Yeah. There you go. And so I remember this whole interview process and just thinking, you know, this could be awesome. You know, I could go work for a company that I've loved my entire life. I could finally find that job that just I'll hold on to forever.
Right. And being in that environment, the creative environment, the atmosphere, like-minded people, forward-thinking people.
Oh, yeah. And I'm thinking, you know, this is, even though it's the Apple store level, it's the very bottom of the food chain. Like, there's so much potential for growth. And look, maybe I'll wind up back in California for, you know, out in Cupertino where their headquarters are. So maybe I'll finally get my dream of going out to California.
Right.
And so I'm thinking, you know, this is it. Like, this is exactly what I wanted. And I think looking back at the time, it was exactly what I wanted. Now is it? Absolutely not. But like at the time, it was like, this is 100% everything that I ever wanted.
I think it's just the human condition. I think we want to know. I think for the most part, we all ask those questions. You know, whether we're in a job that we like or don't like, we always ask, why am I doing this? You know, what does this all mean?
Why the hell would I be doing anything less than reaching my full potential in life? And that was kind of the moment where I knew I had to make the leap. I knew I had to have the conversation with my boss. I knew I had to quit my job.
So you made it through all the rounds of the hiring process. You're actually working for Apple now. What was that like?
So there was this preliminary period of learning, right? I mean, we've got to learn how the store works. They actually teach us every position in the store. So I'm not just learning what the inventory guy is doing. I'm learning what the salespeople are doing. I'm learning what the repair specialists are doing. And, you know, there's a couple of different positions that you kind of shadow. And there's, a couple things that you learn online on the computer. There's some presentations and things you watch. And ultimately, you kind of graduate and you get your position. You're off on your own. And so my position was a family room specialist is what they called it. They actually changed the names now. So it's they don't even have the FRS name anymore, but that's what we were known as, was the FRS. And essentially, we were kind of like this hybrid. We were this in-between position where we worked at the Genius Bar, but for the most part, we focused on iPhones, iPods, iPads. It was very rare that we touched the computer itself. Right. Every now and then, like iTunes stuff with the iPhone and stuff like that would cross over, but we weren't necessarily repairing the computers. And, you know, ultimately, they try to push you to work from that position into the quote-unquote genius role, where you start to learn more about computer repair and stuff. And I mean, I got some of it along the way. You know, you hang out with them long enough, you see everything, you know exactly what people are coming in for, and sometimes you can just fix it for them. So I started to kind of overlap, you know, if they needed help in sales because it was just a super busy day and we were not busy in repair, I would jump in and start selling stuff. I was like the best salesman ever because I think I had talked so many people out of buying iPhones because they would walk in and be like, tell me why I need an iPhone. And I'd be like, well, you probably don't if you're saying that. Like,
Stefan, no.
Like, the way the iPhone works is like, if you know that you really want one, then you get it. Like, I'm not going to try to persuade you to buy something only to have you come back a week later and say you hate it. So I loved sales. I loved every aspect of it and having a little bit of that flexibility to move around in the store and to be able to just, move beyond my position, move beyond my role and what I was required to do. So I liked having a little bit of flexibility there. And then, you know, as time went on, we actually got a whole new store. So there were rumors for the longest time that they were building a new store in a secret spot in the mall. We had no clue where it was. And we were excited because our store was small. I mean, we knew that we had to double or triple in size just because of the amount of foot traffic through there. And, you know, we were really excited until one day I remember kind of walking by this, you know, they cover up the new stores with just plywood and just paint it black or whatever in the mall. And I was walking by as I was leaving and I see my manager sneaking in the door. I'm like, what are you doing? And he's like, you want to come in and see something really cool? And I'm like, yeah,
because that's you disappeared for a year after that. I lost kind of contact.
Right. I just went into Narnia.
I went into Narnia. That was it.
So I walked in and he's like, you know, we haven't made the official announcement yet, but, you know, this is our new store. And he kind of walked me through the wireframe of it. You know, you could see where the rooms were, but nothing was really there yet. I'm like, oh my God, I mean, this is amazing. So not only had I been able to be a part of an iPhone launch, which is a really fun day, by the way, but I was a part of transferring stores where literally I closed down one store one night. I had the closing shift and I had the opening shift in this new store in a different part of the mall the next day. Everything's brand new and shiny. It's three times the size. It was everything we had dreamed of, you know, from working there and just knowing what our limitations were as employees. And so it kind of like renewed my excitement for working at Apple again. And so I really just enjoyed being there because my coworkers were awesome. You know, some of the management and I clashed a little bit, but I think that's really a good sign of like why I'm a good entrepreneur.
Right, like, of course.
I didn't take too kindly to people telling me what to do, but I really was good in that team environment. I loved helping out everybody else. You know, when our lineup of people coming in for repairs was busy, I was knocking it out. I mean, I remember you could go in and see how many appointments you would take in a day. And typically they would have you take a new mobile device appointment every 10 minutes. Like they were giving you only 10 minutes from start to finish. Wow. And 15 minutes if you were working on the Macs, which anyone who's ever been in an Apple store knows that if you're there for a Mac, you might be there for 3 or 4 hours because the stuff they have to do just takes that long.
Yeah.
And so, you know, knowing that limitation and that expectation, I remember sometimes doing 40, 41, 42 appointments in a day. And if you can imagine meeting 42 different people with 42 different problems with their iPhones, and this isn't just a simple wipe it and start over again. Some people I might have to take it into the back and open it up and replace a part. Sometimes I might have to do something on the computer. Like it was always something different. And you're just constantly thinking fast pace on your feet, you know, throughout the day for a regular 7-8 hour shift.
What was the leadership like in that environment? Were they like, oh, keep calm, we're going to get this figured out? Were they always pushing you, we need to get this done, you know what I mean?
There was a constant push because I think that, I don't know if we were understaffed or it was just the fact that this Apple store was not only for all of Baltimore County, but for Baltimore City. Like there was no Apple store downtown. So people were driving in all the way from the city just to get their stuff fixed because this was the only place in town. I mean, the next closest one, I think, was like you had to drive up to Christiana Mall, which is like near Delaware, you know, or Columbia, which is still a solid half hour. It's like totally opposite sides. So I think that, you know, we were really the closest place for anybody. So we just got swamped all the time. And there was one day where I remember, you know, what we would do is people would check in. There's like a check-in person holding an iPad. They kind of diagnose the issue a little bit, write in some notes with the person's name. And then we would always write down notes of like what the person was wearing so that I could walk up to you and be like, hey, John. And they'd be like, how'd you know it was me? I'm like, well, they said you were wearing a blue flannel shirt and jeans, you know, or something like that.
Yeah.
And so, you know, they would check the person in, and instead of me having to go find them, this one day we were so busy, a manager dragged me over to a table and said, you sit here. And she starts populating the chairs, 8 chairs around the table, and just round robin style, like I'm just constantly for like 3 or 4 hours, I'm just going through. And it just, no break in sight, no clue what was going on or why we were getting slammed that day. And it's,
How far along is this in your career at this? I mean, is this
probably like 6 to 9 months into working there?
Okay.
So, I mean, we had moved into this new store. We're still trying to squeeze into the space, but I almost feel like, you know, we had just as many people coming in as we had in the smaller store. They were just now fitting into the bigger space. So we were gaining more people because we had a bigger space. It didn't really relieve any of the pressure.
Right. I see.
And so I think that was kind of like a turning point. Like I remember going home from that day and just being like, I'm going to have a heart attack by 30 if I keep doing this. Like, it's just, I can't do this.
Yeah.
And so this was where things started to transition. I started to look for other positions in the store, seeing if I could transfer more into, there was a role called expert. They were still in sales, but they were kind of higher end. They had a little more flexibility because they had some more knowledge in fixing things and could make better recommendations beyond just buying a phone or buying an iPod. And so I looked into trying to transfer. Like there was a open position in the store. I applied for it and management knew that I was their best person.
Right.
You know, I was the reason why we weren't there an hour past closing, because if we had to catch up, I was kind of like the emergency response team they call in.
Right.
And they were like, no, we're sorry, we can't move you to a different position. And I'm like, why not?
Yeah.
Like, they didn't really have a good answer because they didn't want to tell me I was their best person, but I knew that I was taking more appointments than anyone else in the entire store. Like, that had to be the reason, is they knew that if they took me off of the tech support stuff, that they were just going to get slammed.
Right.
And so, I get barred from moving into this position. I see a position for a video editor opens up in Cupertino, like working for a corporate.
Oh, that's it.
And I'm like, this is it.
Right.
This is it right here. And I go through it on the iPad. Like, we had this system we could log into, so it had the details. And it said minimum requirement, 2 years experience. And I had been with Apple only just over a year.
Oh.
And I kind of asked around and essentially got the answer that, you know, unless you've been there for 2 years, like, they're not going to consider it. And I'm like, are you guys kidding me? Like, if you knew my editing skills, if you sat me down in front of Final Cut Pro, I could tell you I've been doing this since I was in high school. Like, right. I know Final Cut inside and out.
Did you submit anyway?
I think that I did, but it didn't turn into anything. They didn't even consider it. And so things were starting to add up. You know, I'm kind of getting frustrated with the job.
Discouraged. And
yeah. And I mean, I'm getting tired of where I'm at, of just coming in day after day. It's so busy. And like, I think every month every other month we'd have this staff meeting of like, all right, we're going to try this new strategy where we change things up and we're going to like transform the whole way that you take appointments and how this all works. And they literally wouldn't give us enough time to see it through to get it working until they would be like, oh, this isn't working. We're going to try this a different way. Like, corporate passed this down and this is the way we're going to do it.
Right.
And I'm like, you guys have got to be kidding me. If you gave us like one more month to get used to this, we could have totally had it down. No sweat.
Right.
And so at this point, I have no clue what's going to happen next, but I'm getting closer and closer to the breaking point.
Yeah, I mean, and the easiest thing to jump to when you ask people, so why do you do what you do, or you know, what do you enjoy about your job? Oh, I make a good paycheck. You know, I get good benefits. Really, I mean, you could do that anywhere. I mean, you can make more money somewhere else. You could get great benefits somewhere else. What is it about? You know, if there's something that you really love, it's about more than that. The reason that we talk about the money and the benefits are the things that first come out of our mouths is because that's the most obvious stuff. Those are sort of the manifestations of something bigger, but it's hard to talk about because another thing that
I didn't expect to hear that from you about them. I mean, like, pivoting a lot. You know what I'm saying?
You would think that they would find one thing that works and essentially run it into the ground. I mean, isn't that what the iPhone is? Is they found something that works and you know, they add new features here and there, but it's the same darn phone as it was 5 years ago.
Right, right. Okay, so, you know, you're becoming more discouraged with the job. You've been there for, what, about a year now at this point?
Yeah, I was probably in there for just over a year.
And that change in mindset towards this particular job happened when? At about 8 months?
Yeah, somewhere between, like, 6 and 9 months.
So you kind of stuck it out for how long? How long did you continue to...
I think as I got discouraged more and more, it became the norm. Like, I knew that I wasn't going into work to be happy. Like, I knew I was going into work to see the same old stuff.
Paycheck,
you know, it wasn't going to change.
Right.
And the more and more I tried to switch to different roles within the company and realize they were going to bar me at every step of the way, I was just like, there, you know, I won't be able to make the impact in this company that I want to make.
Right.
Because I saw it from the very ground level that they could have made it so much more efficient. Like, I knew how, if I could have sat down with the CEO that day, and that was still, it was Tim Cook at the time, if I could have sat down with him and said, I can show you how this store can work so much better.
Right.
Could have fixed it all.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, you know, it just kind of got to this breaking point of like...
Was there one thing that kind of pushed you over the edge or...
Absolutely. I mean, you know, we were in a customer service role, right? So like... People don't come into you to say, I love my phone. Like, that wasn't what I got paid to do. I didn't get paid to you know, hear good things. I was essentially the therapist. You know, I heard everything from, like, my dog died and the only remaining picture of him is on this phone and I dropped it in the toilet and can you recover it? And just, like...
Yeah, I was going to ask you, what was the craziest thing you've ever heard? Like, someone, you know, like, I don't know.
I just had every sob story of, like... Just people not reading what it said on screen. And it's like, you know, them doing something with, like, when iCloud came out, you know, they just had a baby, they took all these photos, and for whatever reason, like, they went to turn on or off iCloud, and, like, it said, do you want to delete all your photos? And they just said, yes. And they, like, and then they get really upset. They're like, all my photos are gone on my baby. These are the only pictures. She was just born a week ago. And I'm like, did you read what it said on screen? Like, you did, like, you didn't even look. Like, it gives you a cancel option. And so I think it just... nothing was too crazy or far-fetched. I think I found marijuana inside of, like, headphone jacks of phones. They would, like, have trouble getting their earbuds in. And then I'd, like, go get some tweezers and start picking stuff out of it. And I'm like, I can smell this. Like, I know what that is. Or, you know, I had dads who would bring in their daughter's phones and be like, yeah, she just said it stopped working. I'm like, well, did she tell you that it's filled with urine? Because I just opened it up and I can tell you, like, do you want to smell? So it got to a point where I was so tired of people lying about what happened because I had seen it all.
Yeah.
And so I knew it was like, I'm not stupid. You can't get it past me. There's liquid sensors inside. You can smell it. Like, try me.
Yeah.
And so I think probably the craziest one was this girl who came in and said she dropped her phone in her taco salad. And somehow she had enough dressing or salsa
sour
on
cream.
This darn taco salad that it killed her phone. She failed to mention that she, like, you know, dropped it in the sink or something like a week prior. So it was already on the fritz and kind of on its way out.
Yeah.
But they, like, try to give you some excuse because they think you'll replace it for free. So I think that's where it really was just like, I was the ultimate BS meter. Like, it wasn't even a challenge anymore because I knew exactly what had happened. What? Like, from the second they hand me the phone.
Yeah, yeah. This smells like urine. What percentage did you actually replace the phone for them? You know, I'm just curious.
If they didn't lie to me and it seemed like an honest mistake or something... technically things were supposed to be marked as physical damage. Like it wasn't covered. They had to pay for a new phone and the warranty didn't cover physical damage. So if you shattered your screen, like at some point in time, you just had to pay for a new phone depending on the model because we didn't replace screens on the older like 4s and 4s's.
Right.
It was possible, but you literally had to tear the phone apart completely because everything was built into that. The back of the phone was the only piece that came off.
I see.
So it just... it was a complete mess.
You were discouraged. I mean, what happened next? Did you eventually leave or?
Yeah. So all this kind of builds up to one day where a lady comes in and just the way the store was set up was that the front of the room is mostly sales, you know, so like the front 3/4 is sales. The back 1/4 is essentially tech support. And at the very door, at the front of the door, there's someone with a walkie talkie. And me being in tech support, I used to kind of keep one on just so I could hear what's going on and just kind of keep track of everybody. And I heard them call back to me. I was the appointment guy that day. So I was just standing in the middle about halfway down with an iPad, making appointments for anyone who didn't have one, kind of shuffling stuff around, trying to manage the queue of people in line to get help.
Sure.
And so they call back to me. They're like, you know, do you have any available appointments, you know, within the next hour or so? And we were like totally swamped. It just wasn't going to happen. I'm like, no, I'm sorry, boss. Like, yeah. We'll have to get them to sign up for a different day. And as I think she almost heard it through the earpiece on his earpiece. And I see her face and she just comes stomping back towards me. And as she's walking towards me, he goes over the radio. He says something like, you know, she didn't listen. She's coming to talk to you. I'm like, you think? Like, I can't just watch this unfolding in front of me.
I see this tornado coming towards me.
Right. And she gets in front of me, starts just screaming and hollering. The store's got like 200 people in it. And I even see, like, we have a plainclothes security guy that was there all the time. He kind of perked up a little bit because he knew something was about to go down. And she's just screaming in my face, why can't you get me an appointment? I was in here a week ago. That, you know, just giving me the same sob story everybody does.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, even though we were completely swamped and had no space open, like, if she was nice to me and just was like, you know, I had this terrible accident, like, I made a big mistake, I would have found a way to squeeze her in.
Of course.
But you do that, I have no reason to help you out.
Yeah.
And as she's doing, you know, as she's coming down towards me, I look up, and in the corner of the room, like, to the left side of her, is one of the freelance clients that I had been doing video for his real estate school. And I've got to give a huge shout out to Sherman Ragland here. He started a real estate school here in Maryland. He had met me through my old company because the owner, Bill Glazer, was good friends with him. And so that's how I ultimately was freelancing while I was unemployed.
I see.
And I'm like, oh, crap. You know, just like someone I know is watching this whole thing unfold. Like, wow. I wouldn't even want my mom in the store to see what was happening right now. And, you know, he's just kind of like holding the iPad, but like looking up at me, kind of watching what's going on.
Did you acknowledge each other at this point? Or
We locked eyes. He
knew.
I knew he was there.
Yeah.
And you know, she's screaming, yelling. Eventually, she gets taken away by the plainclothes security guy. Yeah, because it was like, look, you can make an appointment online for a different day. Here's a laptop right here. You can do that. But I have no room left for you today.
And then you point she didn't want to hear that. Guy, get her out of here.
Essentially, because she lost it at that point. And so, like, after she's gone, you know, I take a second to recompose myself, check in a couple more people. Because at this point, there's a line of, like, 7 or 8 others behind her of people checking in because they made appointments. Like, they did the right thing.
Right, right.
And didn't freak out about it. And then he kind of walks up to me and was like, what was that? I'm like, that's my job.
That's my job.
That's what I get paid to do. Yeah. And I couldn't believe it that someone I knew had witnessed it. And he's like, what are you doing later tonight? I'm like, get off of work at 6 or whenever. He said, how about this? I'm going to come back later tonight. We're going to get dinner. You know, as soon as you get off work, come over. There's like a steakhouse that was in the mall. It was at the other end of the wing. And he's like, I'll meet you over there, 6:30. Cool. Awesome. No problem. But like the whole rest of my work shift, I'm like, wait a minute. This is like kind of a fancier restaurant. Like I can't afford to like go pay $50 for dinner right now.
Right.
And so I was really kind of worried about that until, you know, ultimately later that night.
I was told to go to school, get good grades, get a job. That was the way to make things work. And it took me many years to find out that I was the worst employee on the planet and I should have never been. So that's how we end up in these situations. The question is do we then develop the courage necessary to actually do something about it?
I think that's one of the things that's misunderstood about pursuing dreams, especially when we talk about dream jobs, that I think there's this, you know, kind of misperception that there's only one dream job. Like if you ask somebody, hey, what's your dream job? They think, you know, so many people lock up because they think they gotta, it's like, I can just pick one and that's gonna be my one thing. And I've realized, and also I've done over 100 interviews with people who have achieved what they would call dream jobs. And we identify dream jobs as either doing work that you love or doing work that allows you to do something you love. And I've you know, had this experience, and all the people that I talked with as well have had this experience, that usually what it is it's deciding what's the dream job for this season.
So my reality is very simple. My reality is that I am in control of my own destiny. I am in control of my situation. So if I'm in control of that, then let's take control of that and let's make something happen.
So you had this irate customer come in, cause this huge scene. You're already discouraged about the job in general. Why didn't you just quit right there on the spot? What held you back from, again, quitting right there on the spot?
I mean, I think it was probably that same piece that had always held me back, was like, you know, you're going off script, man. Like, this is not where you're supposed to be, or this is where you're supposed to be. You're not supposed to deviate from that. And so I think that part of me that was scared or concerned with where I was going and what I was doing with myself was just kind of saying, you know, don't deviate from the script. Like, you're supposed to hold a job. This is where you're supposed to be. This is how it's supposed to work. But then, like, a part of me is just like, why is it working this way? Like, it shouldn't be working this way. So, you know, he invites me out to dinner. I get off work. I remember just like kind of running down the hallway because I had gotten off work late because, of course, we were behind again on the queue of people to help.
Right.
And I'm just like, you know, ripping off my Apple shirt, throwing on my other shirt, just walking down to this place trying to think, I have no clue how I'm going to pay for dinner. Like, what the heck is going to happen tonight? And we sit down for dinner, just kind of like, just shoot it for a little bit. And then eventually, before we even order, he asks the waitress to bring over just like a bar napkin, just like a little square napkin. And he pulls out, you know, like the fancy silver pen from his jacket. Yeah, right, I'm like, right. Oh my God, like that's probably like a $500 pen or something right there. And he just draws out this little stepladder, just these little like 12 stairs. And, you know, he hands me the pen and the piece of the napkin. And he says, you know, put zero at the bottom. So I write it in. He's like, how much do you make right now? I'm like, what? Like, we were just talking about, like, today and what happened and where I was. How much do you make? Roughly, I had actually gotten a raise. So ultimately, I wound up, I got like an $8,000 raise at some point. And that was through the process of moving to the new store and just some changes. But I think minimum wage had gone up or something. So they like had to give everyone a raise. So I was at like 38,000 by that point. But, you know, just for the sake of numbers, you know, I think I said 30 because, you know, even after taxes, it's not like that 8,000 mattered. Like it was just gone. And so, you know, I put 30 at the top. And he's like, all right, do you know how much money you would have to make each month to replace your current income? Like, I don't know. I have no idea. He says, pull out your calculator. Like, you have a smartphone, use the calculator, do the math here. And, you know, if you do the math on it and you take that 30,000 and you start to divide it by 12, you start to figure it out. So, you know, 15,000 over 6 months, you know, you can break it down even further over 2 months. That's essentially 5,000. So once a month, it's $2,500 a month.
Right.
And so finally, like, the number's getting smaller, and I'm like, all right, like, what's he getting out here? And he's like, do you know how to make $2,500 a month? And I'm like, work at the Apple store and keep getting a paycheck?
Is
this a trick question? Like, what am I supposed to say?
And so you still had, at that point, you still had the linear career mindset.
Oh, yeah. Right. I mean, I wasn't even thinking in turn. And it's funny because, like, I had freelanced for a couple months in between jobs.
Yeah.
So, like, I had gotten a taste of that, but my mind wasn't even thinking there yet.
Right.
And I'm like, I have no clue how I'm going to make $2,500 a month. And he says, okay, well, what if you were just doing the math of, like, you work 5 days a week normally right now, you know, 40 hours a week. What if you do that math? And it essentially came out to, like, if you make, you know, 100, 120 bucks in a day, 5 days a week, you were replacing your income. And it wasn't until he had broken it down that far where I was like, holy crap, mm-hmm. like, this is actually doable.
Manageable.
You know, I looked at 30,000, I looked at 2,500, I'm like, this is not manageable, but 120 bucks in a day, I can find a way to do it. You know, I'm not going to go open up a lemonade stand, but, like, there are skills that I have as being, you know, a tall male who's strong enough to lift 40, 50 pound boxes. You know, there was something I could have done.
Right.
And so this was really kind of this changing point to me of, you know, just how I was thinking about money and how I was thinking about how I could replace my income. And it had never really been a thought in my mind that I could replace my income outside of a job. Like, it just, for some reason, it didn't click until that night. And so he kind of turns to me after this realization, you know, the light bulb clicks on, and he's like, here's what you're going to do. You're going to quit your job tomorrow. And you're going to walk in, you're going to write up a resignation letter. When you get home tonight, you're going to quit your job tomorrow. I'm like, what? Excuse me? Wait, I don't like people telling me what to do. Like, this is why I'm not happy here.
You're going to quit your job.
But for some reason, I listened.
Yeah.
And, you know, I went home, I typed up a letter, and I remember telling my mom I'm going to quit and start my own business.
What did she say?
Oh, I actually don't even know if I can, like, remember how she reacted, but I think it was more that, like, I don't know if you're making a good idea. Like, right. You know, it wasn't that she didn't support me. It was more of just, she was worried and she was concerned and she just wanted the best.
Right.
So it was never like this angry talk of like, I can't believe you're doing that. It was just like, I don't know
what
you're doing.
She's worried about you, you know, yeah, I get it.
Yeah. So I mean, I remember walking in and I had the letter in hand and I'd been talking to a couple of my, you know, peers there at work. And I said, you know, I'm just going to quit. And I remember one of them was just like, you won't do it. He was an older guy. And I really liked him because he was a photographer by trade, and we got along really well, had a lot in common. But, you know, he's probably in his late 40s, you know, and had a business for like 20 some years. And ultimately, when the economy tanked in 09, it went under. And so he got a job with the Apple Store. But I remember him saying, like, you won't do it. There's no way. You're not going to do it. And I remember flashing the envelope when I walked in the next day. And I'm like, and he's like, he was like, I don't know why you're waiting. Like, you should just go do it now. Because I was going to wait until I felt comfortable in my day. Like, I didn't want to do it and then have to work my whole shift that day.
Right.
And he's like, I don't know why you're waiting. And it was almost like he was egging me on. Like, converted to this point where he was like, oh, he's going to make it work. You know, I don't know. But I think I waited. I waited for a couple hours until finally he was like, what are you doing, man? If you're going to quit, just do it.
Yeah.
And so I took the letter and I pulled the general manager aside and I was like, you know, I want to let you know that I've decided that I'm going to be leaving. And this letter is my letter of resignation. This is my 2 weeks notice. You know, if you guys need to keep me on for 4 weeks, that's fine. Just let me know. But, you know, I'm putting in my intent. And he was shocked. He had no idea it was coming. And I think the manager in general, like, he just wasn't really around the store that often. So he didn't really know what was going on in his own store. He just didn't have a grip on it. So it totally blindsided him. But I remember just the relief of getting that done with. It was almost like working my shift didn't matter. Like, you could have that same angry person come back in and have it happen again. I'll be like,
yeah,
drop the mic. I don't care. I'm out. You know, it didn't matter at that point. I felt this sense of freedom already.
Right. Right. What did the guy say, by the way, your coworker friend who said, you're not going to do it?
I think his jaw dropped a little bit.
Is he still there, by the way?
You know, I don't know. I've gone in there like once or twice a year ever since I left in 2013. And I feel like every time I've gone in, like 50% of the people I knew are now gone. And then 50% of that are gone. And so it's like last time I was in there, I knew like
one
manager and one person working in sales. Yeah. And like, that was it.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think he's actually wound up in a great place.
Nice.
I know that at some point he had been going through some tough times personally and with his family and stuff. And I think he's in a much better place wherever he is. I haven't talked to him, you know, since I left, but I wish the best for all of them. You know, some of my coworkers I didn't get along with, but he was one of those ones where, you know, I genuinely cared about him. So
that's awesome.
I think he's in an all right place.
Okay. So at this point you quit Apple. Where did you go from there? Is this where you started ZMB Media? Is this, you know?
Yeah, so this was a big part of our talk when I had that dinner was, you know, if I'm going to quit, like, I need to have some sort of a plan of what's next. And so he said, you know, you've been doing videography for me and you do a great job with it. You've got some of the gear. You have the tools that you need to get going. You know, why don't you do that? And it kind of made sense. You know, for me, it's like, well, I love doing video stuff. It's what I went to college for, so it would be much more in alignment with where I'd originally wanted to go. So, I mean, it just seemed like the logical next step. And so I think, you know, I probably took a day or two to just kind of research ideas and just think things through and give myself that separation between the job and what I was about to do, because I knew whatever came next was going to be big. You know, it was going to require a lot more work. It was going to be a lot tougher. And I just, it's so much more uncertainty. And, you know, I took a little bit of a break. I went home, kind of explained it to my mom, you know, hey, like, I just quit my job. My plan is I'm going to start a company and I'm going to start doing this video stuff full time.
Were you formulating this prior to you quitting?
No, because I had never seen it as possible.
Right.
It wasn't until that dinner where he was like, you know, $120 5 days a week, you can do this. So it was never really even an option that presented itself until he had broken it down into such a small attainable goal where it was like, oh, I can do that. So it was, you know, it became this option that was slowly becoming possible for me. And using how he taught me to break down this big goal of replacing this $30,000 income into this small, really much more easy to
tangible.
Yeah. So using that strategy, I kind of looked at it and changed it up and said, okay, this top piece, this $30,000 is create a business. And this bottom piece, this $0 sign is where I am right now. And I broke it down and it was like, well, I know that there's a few aspects of a business, right? Like there's money, there's legality, you know, there's getting clients, there's marketing, there's a couple different pieces to this. So those were the 12 steps in between.
Right.
And then, you know, legality became like, let's figure out what we have to do. You know, we have to have a business checking account. But before you have a business checking account, I learned from the Small Business Administration website, you've got to get a federal tax ID number. So a lot of it was like Googling and just kind of like learning as
At this point, you're starting to reverse engineer everything.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Using that same idea of like, you've got this big goal up here, you've got this little goal down here. You know, there's definitely a way to get from zero to that top highest point. You just have to find it. Right. And I think that we live in a world where people are kind of lazy and sometimes don't want to put the effort forth to figure out what it takes to get there. You know, many of us want it to be just handed to us on a silver platter. Now, I'm not saying that a doctor who has a job and has a boss doesn't have a valuable skill. They have an extremely valuable skill. But what I'm saying is for people like me, you know, we don't operate the same way. We don't, our brains just don't allow us to work in an organization where there's this leadership above us. We want to be that creative thinker that's free to change and move as need be.
When the reality is, I realize that everything happens for a reason, but it is our responsibility to choose the reason. You know, we can choose reasons that are victim reasons, like, oh, bad things happen to me all the time, I'm unlucky, and blah, blah, blah. Or we go, you know what? This sucks. This is the worst thing that ever happened to me, but I'm going to make this my greatest comeback. I'm going to, you know, use this adversity, turn it into an advantage. I'm going to help other people. I'm going to, whatever, however you want to do that.
You know, I don't like it when people resist the realities of life, right? I think there's always a need for balance.
And so I, you know, wanting to figure out where I fell into place with a business, I just kind of realized, okay, I've got to start this business. And I just broke it down into those pieces and, you know, got the tax ID, got the bank account set up. And a lot of that just came through asking questions, finding business owners that had done it already, saying, what'd you do? Well, I went to the bank and met with a banker and they told me how to start a business account.
So you did it the right way then. You did all the research prior to jumping into the pool, right?
Yes and no. I mean, I think that when I had to apply to become a business, so I had to get an LLC, I didn't know about LegalZoom at the time. I didn't know I could go to this website and spend $200 and have a legal entity.
Right.
And so for me, it was asking around. I think we found out through like a family friend of ours who was an attorney that, you know, I could use this local law office here and they would do it for me. And it was like $800. And being naive and just not knowing of any other opportunities, I went for it. I spent the $800. They made the LLC. It was quick and painless. They did it all for me. But they come back at the end of it and they're like, you know, you could have just walked to the small business office downtown, paid your $50 or $100 or whatever it is and done this. And I'm like, are you kidding me? Like I spent $800, you know, I'm starting from zero. Like I don't realistically have $800 to spend. Mm-hmm. And you could have just told me to go and spend my $100, $150, whatever it was in an office that I could drive to.
Right. Yeah.
So part of it was trial by fire and learning from those mistakes, but it was never really, I don't know what to do next, I'm going to stop here. It was always, I'm not quite sure what to do next. I'm either A, going to Google for the answer, or B, you know, find someone who's been here before and figure out what the next step was. So, you know, within about 2 weeks of quitting, I had the LLC, I had the bank account, you know, I had a couple $100 in the bank account, so it was ready to go. You know, I had my business checks. I was essentially open for business. But I was still, you know, making invoices off of like Google Doc templates. You know, I had no clue how to make invoices. So these were all things that I figured out later on. It was never from the get-go. But the first thing I did was say, you know, how am I going to get clients? And when I told him that, the person I had dinner with, Sherman, he was like, well, I'm hiring you. Like, I am your first client. I need you in like 2 or 3 weeks. What are you doing? And I was like, well, I don't have a job anymore, so I'm not
doing
much.
You just told me to quit.
Right. So, I mean, he was my first client. And if you go back at the invoices, you'll find it. And I just remember kind of like connecting with other people I had known from the previous marketing company before I was at Apple, and just things started to pop up and they started to give me some projects and things to work on. And I just started doing more and more work. And before you know it, you know, I had left Apple in halfway through 2013. So I had 6 months left in the year. So if I was replacing that roughly 30K income, like I had to make 15,000 between
June and December,
you know, June and December.
Yeah.
And sure enough, I pulled it off. I made that 15,000.
How important do you think it is to have that goal set up? A lot of people just go into it and arbitrarily have these things on the horizon. Was it important for you? It sounded like you always had the end game in mind, even if it was limited to a 10-yard view.
Yeah, I mean, I think I kind of fooled myself into thinking it was this life or death scenario of, you know, if you don't pull this off, mom's kicking you out of the house. And game over.
Right.
And so I had kind of, I don't know how I really pulled it off, but what I did was essentially convince myself, if you don't do this in the next 6 months, you will be that person on the street that you saw when you were driving to the video shoot, you know, asking for money. And that never was going to happen. Look, like my mom wasn't just going to kick me out on the street, but I had kind of narrowed my view into this fear of thinking like that's where I could end up if I don't pull this off. Like I'm going to encourage and inspire myself into doing everything possible to not be that person.
Right, right. The business. Okay, so you jumped in, you quit Apple, you have a few clients on your belt now, you formed this new business. How's it evolving?
Yeah, so when I started, I mean, I knew I wanted to start the business, but I was never really a fan of business plans. Like I actually did some research online thinking, okay, maybe I have to do that. But then there right. were all these people who were like, business plans are crap. Like you don't need this.
Yeah.
And for me, I was like, I kind of thought, what do I need a business plan for? Like I shoot video, you pay me, we're done.
Right, right, right. Very simple.
Yeah. And so, I mean, I kept busy through the summer and ever since I left, but it was kind of at this point where I'm like, I really don't know how I'm going to get past this notion of just $30,000. Like $30,000 is not going to allow me to move out of my mom's house. It's not going to allow me to get my own place, not going to allow me to support any future relationships. Like it's not going to take me anywhere. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'll be able to pay my bills. I'll be able to kind of get by, but it's like, wasn't I already only just doing that at the job?
Right, 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 right.
So, you know, drastic times call for drastic measures. And I had been invited by my friend Mara, who was actually my old supervisor at the marketing company. So Bill Glazer, his daughter was Mara. She ran the social media department and she was my direct boss.
Right.
And
this is a job right out of college.
Yeah. So this was the job right out of college. She was actually became a really good friend of mine after we both were let go from that company. So we were essentially kind of like drinking buddies in a sense. You know, right. We go out, hang out with friends, grab dinner, you know, get together for the Super Bowl, stuff like that. And so at this point, I had never really looked at her in any different light other than just a good friend, former boss. And she became a business coach. She invited me to this conference she was putting on in like, I think it was like September of that year. And 3-4 day conference in a hotel, you know, probably 300 people in attendance. I thought it would be a great networking opportunity to meet local business owners.
Right.
And, yeah, you know, definitely. Maybe they'll turn into clients. Who knows? Like Mara had been kind of giving me some work because she used video to sell tickets to that conference. So I'd already been kind of working with her a little bit from like a business standpoint.
Yeah.
But, you know, I had no clue what was going to happen next because I got to this event. I went there with my buddy Carson, who I met when Mara and I created the Towson Young Entrepreneurs meetup group on meetup.com. So we've been doing just monthly happy hour stuff. And the funny thing is Carson was there like a week or two before I decided to quit. So I remember being at a bar with him and saying, yeah, man, like I really don't like my job. Like I think I'm going to quit. And so it's kind of funny because that was the first time I met him.
Right.
And then like the second time we hung out was he comes to this conference with me about building and growing a business. And so there's this totally night and day shift here. And we're just, you know, we're sitting at the conference and she pulled me aside before she was about to make her big pitch for this coaching program she was running. And she pulls me aside and just says, hey, you know, like, we want to sell X amount of people into this program. One of the strategies we use is we plant some people in the audience so that, like, when we say the first 10 people to the back of the room get this discount, like, we want you to take your order form and be, like, running to the back of the room. We want you to be the first one there, you know, and it's just to encourage more people in the audience to buy it and that, the, you know, that deal is going to run out. It's that urgency. And so, you know, she gives me the form and, you know, the speech happens. You know,
right.
She's giving her pitch. She's talking about what, you know, we would work on over a 12-month coaching program. Yeah. And it was funny because, like, there were certain times where out of a room of 300 people, I almost felt like she was looking right at me and talking to me. Like,
so you were,
I wasn't sure.
You were digesting this yourself.
Yeah. I mean, like, I didn't know if she was just trying to make it seem authentic. Like, you know, she didn't want to fake it. Like, she's not talking to me and I just run up and go. But I just, there was this point in time where I almost felt like when she was talking about, you know, the need to grow your business and what this could do for you and how this could change your life, like, I almost felt like she was on stage and just, like, only talking to me, and she was looking at me. So there was kind of like this flip-flop feeling of, like, I don't know, like, maybe this is actually something I should do too. Like,
yeah,
I was set up to think I'm just planted as this fake in the audience.
Yeah.
But as the pitch is going on, I'm like, maybe this is a good idea. I mean, and I know her. So she's like someone that I trust. She was my boss. I knew she had this experience. It's not like it's just this stranger getting up on stage.
Right.
And so I'll never forget, like, the time came in her pitch where she's like, all right, you know, first X amount of people to the back of the room, get this discount or whatever. And, you know, I run to the back of the room and I've got my papers and I hand it to her assistant, and her assistant was in on it. She knew, and she goes to, like, rip it up. And I'm like, no, don't do that. Like, she's like, what? I'm like, don't rip it up. Like, I think I want to do this. And I didn't, like, totally commit at the time. So, right. I was, like, still acting because I was the first person back there.
Yeah.
But she wasn't going to, like, rip it. I think she was going to, like, throw it to the side or something, like, not in the same pile. But I'm like, no, like, I actually think I want to. And then, like, Mara invited me into, there was this, like, VIP lunch for anyone who had signed up on the spot. So, like, she was like, yeah, like, I need you to, like, keep playing the role because you, like, pretended to be.
Right,
yeah.
Now.
So I, like, go into the lunch and, you know, she's already sold these people in, right? Like, that has been covered. But in the lunch, I feel like she was still going for a little bit more of justification just to, like, explain to these people. And I think Carson was another plant too. So we both were invited into this lunch and we're kind of sitting here talking to other people and, like, making sure we're still faking it and,
right,
like, convincing
right.
them we just spent $11,000 on a coaching program.
Right.
And so they're asking him what he does. At the time, he was employed at Krav Maga. So, like, he's just teaching, like, self-defense stuff. Like,
yeah.
He doesn't work for himself.
Yeah.
He's trying to pull it off as, like, we're business partners. So he's pretending like he does video with me. The whole thing was kind of wild. But, like, through that lunch, I'm still thinking, like, man, like, maybe this is where I need to be.
Yeah.
And it didn't quite click until a couple days later where I had this call on the phone with her. And I remember telling her, I was like, do you really think I can pull this off? And she was like, look, like, I've been your boss. I know your work. I've seen your work. I totally think you can do this. She was like, I think you can easily make double what you were making at the Apple store. And the whole point of her coaching program was to get people to six figures or as close as possible to six figures.
But there's a lot of people that don't need to be entrepreneurs that just aren't doing what they really are cut out for work-wise, and they have no business trying to start their own niche.
Actually pointed out to me how I was showing up as a business person and what that really meant to my clients. And, you know, being the entrepreneur that I am, I'm like, that was a great personal awareness, but then I immediately was thinking, well, great, how can I use that? How can I leverage that to make even more money? But it was truly a turning point in my career because then I amped that. I'm like, okay, if this is my core skill in life, like, my core skill is that I'm able to help people be more responsible in their lives than they even are asking for, then let me do more of that.
I would say 75 to 80% of people don't live the life they should be living, but they live the life trying to please others.
How important do you think it is to have validation from people close to you? A lot of people don't share, you know, like when I started my business,
yeah,
I didn't share a lot of personal details, even with my closest friends,
mm-hmm.
you know, how important do you think that is to have someone like her
I think it means the difference between you failing and you succeeding, because fortunately I was just thick-skinned enough to ignore my grandparents.
I was going to ask, that's my next question.
You know, freaking out and saying, what are you doing? And ignore my mom, who wasn't angry but was concerned, and ignoring essentially what everyone had said. If they had all gone and said, oh my gosh, you could totally do this, like this is exactly where you should be, I would probably be 10 times further than where I am right now. But it probably took about getting 2 years into my business and proving that I was successful for 2 years, and it wasn't just a fluke that the first
proving
year
to
worked,
yourself or proving to
them
family
before they even like accepted that it was a possibility for me. Like they had to see that it wasn't just this fluke that I was successful for the first year. Like I had to get through a second year.
Right.
And you know, the stats are bad. If you look at them, it's something like, you know, 50% of businesses fail in the first year, and then 70% to 80% of those that remain fail in the second year.
Right.
So, I mean, they knew it was tough.
Right.
But I think that if they had...
Did they support you along the way? They saw determination. Did they support you?
Yeah, no one ever like spoke down about it and said, you're making a big mistake.
Like, you're going to give up on this. Come on, you got to get back in the workforce.
And I think part of it was because like how confident I was. And I was, you know, when I really claimed what I was doing and owned it, then they got it. It clicked with them. They were like, okay, like he's going to try this thing and it'll probably fail. And then he'll figure it out and he'll go back and work at the Apple store or something like that. So like there was never anyone at that point who was saying you can't do this or you won't do this. But it was definitely a very concerned, you know, we're worried for your well-being and if you're making good decisions.
Right.
And a big part of that was because, look, I had quit my job, had a little bit of money in savings, but not much. And I remember I took $5,000 that I had saved up and I called this my If I F This Up fund. I threw it into a Scottrade account and just like started investing it in Disney stock and just like let it sit there.
Yeah.
And, you know, I take her on as a coach. It's an $11,000 program. I don't have $11,000. I put it on a credit card. And, you know, I was really hesitant to tell my mom how much it costs.
Right.
You know, it's one thing to tell mom, hey, Ma, I, you know, quit my job and I hired this coach and they're going to teach me what I need to know.
Uh-huh.
It's another thing to say, hey, I live under your roof and I just invested $11,000 that I don't have and I'm making these crazy financial decisions.
Right.
And I'm not even like making money.
Right.
And the craziest part about that was, you know, we started the coaching program in like September. We had quarterly retreats where we would travel to somewhere and stay in a hotel for a weekend and mastermind and work on our businesses. But I think it was either January or February of the following year, I had my first $10,000 month.
Wow.
And it's like, well, $11,000 for the program just made 10K.
Right.
You know, within 3-4 months of being in this program, I already paid it off.
Right.
So that was the first time where I was like, whoa, okay, I'm doing, like, I didn't make a bad choice because I was able to pay this off. Like, right. I will not be in debt because of this.
I was like, I'll just be totally honest with you. I'm just like a kid in my bedroom trying to make a few bucks. And they're like, okay, well, we still want them. So, like, what if we overnighted you a check for, like, $10,000? I mean, I don't remember exactly how much, but it was something like that. And I was like, yeah, that would help. And so I'll never forget, like, most important, I think it was the first FedEx envelope I ever got. And I peeled it open, opened it up, and there was a check made out to me. I'd never signed a contract or anything. It's like, Eric James, you know, $10,000. And I was like, whoa. So that was like my first taste of just a whole other world that I didn't know could exist.
Was that because of strategies you learned from Mara?
I think that...
Or combination of everything.
A combination, yeah. So I think that... I think Mara's stuff totally worked. Like,
yeah,
to a certain extent, because the way that stuff was taught, I couldn't keep up with what she was teaching, only because it takes you 2-3 times as long to implement.
Right.
Versus, you know, she can teach it in an hour-long class.
Right, right.
So part of it was more of just like I was behind to a certain extent. But I certainly think that the other half of this was that I had now put myself out there. I had taken the leap. There was no looking back because I already jumped off the cliff.
Right.
It's a matter of, okay, you know, is the parachute going to open?
Yeah.
And that month it did, you know, that in, it was either January or February, that 10K month where I could look back in my system and see I did $10,000. I did five figures in 1 month.
Wow.
That's where it was like, all right, parachute open now. Right. I can just glide it down slowly.
Right. When did that high wear off, basically, of making the 10K, knowing, okay, wait, that was a great month. Now I'm back to square one, and it's the first again. I have a decent amount of savings now that I've collected over the course of this month. Now you're back to square one. Did that fear come back at all?
I think it came back the next month.
Right.
Because I started riding that roller coaster of...
You didn't allow yourself to fall into the trap or the rabbit hole of like, oh, I've made it done, locked in, and then you noticed everything else starts to slip. You know, like a lot of people make it...
Yeah, I mean, I didn't sit back and coast.
Right.
It was not like, okay, did it, I'm done, drop the mic, right. I'm out.
Right.
But it was certainly... I mean, this was where I first saw that roller coaster, because for the months leading up to that, it was just like, you know, a little $500 project here, a little $300 project there. Mm-hmm. But now I get this huge $10,000 month, and it's like, if the bar on the graph is not at the same height or close to it for the next month, you know, and it's all the way down much lower,
right,
then you start to see that roller coaster. So I think the fear really came back in immediately at the end of the following month, because I'm like, whoa, like I only did 3,000 this month or something.
So the bar for you at that point was set at $10,000 a month.
Yeah.
And
but then I realized it wasn't sustainable to do that, or I thought it wasn't sustainable to do that every month, because the next month if I do $2,000 or $3,000, I'm like, so yeah, what's gonna happen next month? $400?
Right.
Like, where
right.
am I gonna be?
Right. I get you. Right.
So it was not something where I just sat back and let it coast, but at the same time, like, it hit me, you know, within the next 30 days of seeing, okay, like, this is not the norm for every single month. Yet.
Right, but it definitely gave you breathing room.
Sure, absolutely.
Right. Okay, so what time of year was this? You had the 10K month.
10K month was probably around January, February.
Okay, so you started to...
I started off the year strong.
Strong. And then you're on that roller coaster, you started to come down the hill... Through all of this, did you ever think that you weren't cut out for being an entrepreneur?
I think...
When you were coming down the hill.
Yeah, I mean, there was definitely a couple of points where I think at that time I was in a newer relationship. So after the one that I was in college, I was in another relationship now, and I'm starting to think, like, you know, I've got to work all the time. This is not just I work 9 to 5 anymore. I mean, I'm editing at 2 o'clock in the morning. I'm sitting there on a Friday night researching when the next networking event is to put on my calendar.
Did you put relationships on pause? Did you not pursue relationships?
Oh, no, I very much pursued it. And so I don't know if that was...
You're still a young man.
Yeah, I mean, right. I don't know if it was the best decision, but I most certainly was pursuing a relationship. So... I think the big challenge...
So you weren't locked away completely like a hermit. You were...
No.
Okay, but you were working like crazy and trying to maintain a relationship. Go ahead.
And stressing out that relationship, because instead of, you know, wanting to volunteer to go out on a Friday night and have fun, I had almost convinced myself that it would be more fun to work on the business and be home on a Friday night. And it wasn't that it was fun, it was that... I felt that I would be more productive, that I couldn't lose, you know, an hour of working on my business for anything else, because the only thing that mattered was making sure that business was successful. And so I had, you know, created this thought in my head of like, you know, if I put everything into this business and this business becomes successful, then I can take care of my girlfriend and I can build a family and I can, everything else can fall into place because I'm financially secure, because I had that fear of money. I had that fear thinking that, okay, like money solves everything. Money's all I need in this world to get me to where I need to go. And this was a huge learning point as an entrepreneur, because, you know, towards the end of that year, which we'll get to in a little bit here, I started to not like money. Hmm. I started to want to get away from it all. So we'll talk about that in a little bit, but it certainly was troublesome, because here I am thinking like, I'm like even afraid to like buy dinner for the girl I'm dating at that time, because like it's money that I have to spend when I could have been sitting at home working on the business, making money.
Right.
Which I wouldn't have. Like, look, it's a Friday night. I'm probably sitting at home watching Netflix. But like,
right.
I was convinced.
I doubt that, by the way, but go ahead.
I mean, I was convincing myself that I would be more productive by not working on the relationship, and that everything I had to do had to be solely based around the business. And, you know, I was also getting to quite an interesting point in time because I actually fired my first client around then. So
fired your first client?
Fired a client. So I, you know, I won't name any names, but I had a client I was working with who is very tough to work with.
Right.
And look, some people clash. I get it. Like, that's just how it is.
Right.
But I did a few projects with them, and ultimately I decided, I, you know, in a very nice way, I said, look, you know, we definitely have a difference of opinion, and I don't think it's good for us to work together anymore.
Was that going to be a decent paycheck for you?
Absolutely, because he never once questioned how much I was going to charge. Like, I could literally double my prices overnight. He would have just written the check.
And you were confident enough just to walk away from that and say...
Well, it took a little bit. I had to think it through. I actually asked Mara's help, I think, and right. maybe one or two other people's opinions, because I didn't know if I was making the right choice. Like, I thought kind of back to the Apple store, like, maybe I just need to suck it up and keep going because it's going to be a nice paycheck.
Right. So being an entrepreneur... was clearly impacting your social life?
Yeah, totally. But it went beyond just telling friends that I couldn't go out. It went beyond, you know, not going out and building up my relationship, because my way of coping with things, which I had always had since I was in college, was going to the gym. And when I got home from college, fresh out of college, I joined a CrossFit gym. I was like super into CrossFit, like hardcore, eating paleo all the time. And so like I loved going into the gym. And so for me, in like dealing with the stress and where I was at, like I would love to go into the gym at 9 o'clock at night and just lift and blast some music and you know, have a good time. And on top of my personal relationship suffering from, you know, everything going on and me kind of ignoring it and putting the business at the forefront and putting the relationship on the back burner, I'm in the gym one night. It's like 9:30 at night. And, you know, I get this call from my stepmom, and clearly like something's up. Like, I have no idea, but she's like, where are you right now? And I was like, I'm at the gym. And she's like, all right, like, give me like 10 minutes. I've got to come talk to you in person. I'm like, whoa. Like, what is going on right now? Yeah. Like, did somebody die? Like, what, you know, when like someone makes this thing that's so urgent and they don't give you any clue as to what's going to happen.
You're going to prepare yourself for something.
Yeah. And, you know, she comes into the gym, she gives me a big hug, and she says, you know, I want you to know that none of this was your fault, but your father and I are splitting up.
Oh, man.
Now, this is my stepmom. So my mom divorced my dad when I was 2.
Yeah.
But here I am trying to start a successful business, looking for everyone in the world to try to support me because I need anyone I can to say, you can do this. Yeah. And now 2 parents are out of the equation because they've got their whole thing that they're dealing with now. Now, fortunately, it didn't affect me as much because, look, like, I'm out of college. I'm already in the real world.
Right.
But I had many younger brothers that were still very much affected by this.
Right, right.
And so... I think that started to give me a clue as to why family and your personal life and your relationships cannot fall to the back burner when you're an entrepreneur. There are certain things you can balance out. There are certain things you can push off to the side. But, you know, they always say family first.
Right.
And so I think this was the first sign where it was like, whoa, I need to take a step back and look at what's happening for the people around me and not just what's happening for me. You know, I had been so caught up in the business and in thinking, like, I'm an entrepreneur. I'm going to work every hour of the day.
Grind.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I was on the grind.
Yeah.
And this was the first time where it, like, smacked me in the face.
Right.
Of, like, hey, there's more to this than just you.
Right. Yeah. It's funny because I'm hearing more entrepreneurs say this. 5 years ago, grind. You know what I mean? Like, and you're right. Not going out on Friday night, not sitting around watching Netflix, not doing all this. You're just grinding till 2 a.m, whatever, you know, family secondary, health secondary.
Oh yeah.
But now I'm starting to hear that's not the correct way. Family first, health close second, everything else
To an extent. I mean,
to an extent.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not saying you need to be in the gym 5-6 days a week, right? Like, I'm not saying that you've got to be grinding it out in the gym.
Oh, all, no, I think you could do 30 minutes.
Right. You get moving 30 minutes, 3 days a week. You're fine. Like, I'm not saying you've got to grind it out in the gym just as much as you have to grind it out in work.
Yeah.
You know, there are certain things that you can let slip away temporarily as long as you understand that, like, this is giving you back that time that you absolutely must be productive with in the business, in the relationship. You know, that time that you're taking away from that investment in yourself and your own health still has to go back and get reinvested into some other place, some other area of your life that still impacts your relationships or your health.
Right. Right. I get it. So your stepmother and your father divorced, your brothers, you said you have younger brothers, correct?
So I have a total of 6 younger brothers on that side of the family.
6? So did you have to step in and play big brother more than you were doing before?
You know, I think I actually chose to stay out of it. Part of it was because my dad became Orthodox when I was about 8 or so years old.
Right.
So, you know, he married to my stepmom when I was probably 5. And when I was 8 or 9, he became an Orthodox Jew. And so I had, ever since my bar mitzvah, kind of been very far from that. At 13, you know, I moved in with my mom and my stepdad full time, decided that that lifestyle wasn't for me. So, you know, I had already been out of that for like 7 or 8 years. I just wasn't really a member of that community anymore. So I probably stopped by to see my brothers more often. You know, partially because I think they got like 2 dogs to help lessen the blow. So the dogs were adorable. But I mean, I love spending time with my brothers. And it's interesting now looking back is like I really didn't spend that much time with them now. But some of them I'm much more closer with as they've gotten older because the age range was nuts. The youngest one was 16, 17 years younger than me. So it's not even like we had much in common. You know, yeah. I can hold an intelligent conversation.
Yeah. You shift into your 20s and your 30s, that gap closes.
Yeah, and I'm in this entrepreneurial mindset. So, yeah, can I talk to the older ones about what I'm doing? And 1 or 2 of them might be interested. Yeah, but
I was going to say, do any of them have that entrepreneurial spirit that you've seen yet?
It's funny, the middle one who, so, you know, the 2 older ones are studying in a yeshiva in Jerusalem. Wow. The middle one just started his freshman year at Drexel.
Wow.
And this is the first of the kids that's going to, you know, like a, I don't want to call it normal because what's normal?
Yeah,
it's different for everybody, but like he's going to a rather secular school.
Right.
And so this was the first one where like, whoa, you're going on my path. Yeah, good going, man. So like he actually, it's pretty wild. He started his own business by accident of like being like servers and waiters because all these people who had events and banquets and weddings and bar mitzvahs, you know, always had meals afterwards with hundreds of attendees.
Right.
And he like accidentally started this business where he built up his group of guys and he would staff these events and get paid in cash under the table, didn't have to pay taxes. Like, so he went into college.
Paid plenty of taxes.
But like, you know, he went into college with this experience of at, you know, 17 years old, having started his first company in a sense. I mean, he didn't go through it like building an LLC out or anything like the way I had, but like he understood what it was like to manage and run a team and to show up on time and to be professional and to collect the money and to pay out your guys. So he was the first of my siblings to get that different experience of the
was
realm that I
Drexel
was
Drexel or during Drexel?
No, he's a freshman at Drexel right now.
Oh,
this is before he even went to college.
Where did he learn those tools?
You know, it's funny, like
DNA?
It could be. You know, my dad's a chiropractor, works for himself, started his own practice. You know, and before that, his father was a jeweler and worked for himself. So, I mean, it's totally possible.
Yeah.
But I think it really was something where by accident, he stumbled upon this opportunity and was aware enough, had that self-awareness to say, whoa, like, I can actually take this further.
Right.
I had the honor and privilege of being the head of security for a gentleman named Tony Robbins for 5 years. I was assistant for another 5 years. For 10 years, I was with Tony, traveling with him all over the world. And you get that mindset, right? That you can basically do anything if you, you know, control the way you manage your mind. And he calls it state management. And that's one of the things I talk about now is how to manage your state in the appropriate way at the appropriate time, which is a skill set that, that everybody could have, but few people really employ. So, you know, one thing this gave me is a strong reference for being able to handle anything. And so when life is not easy. I mean, there's things that are being thrown at you all the time, whether it's financial, relationships, whatever it may be, and you got to deal with it. And this, beforehand, I dealt with it. I probably dealt with it okay, but now I deal with it with a whole different level of certainty.
So you're through the first year, and you've beat the numbers. The 50 to 75% of businesses aren't capable of doing right after the, out of their first year. It's a failure rate, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Where'd you go from there? You're into your second year. What's going on?
So this is where I started to get a little uneasy because, you know, I'd finished up this coaching program. I'd paid back the $11,000. I'd built a business. Essentially, I was on track to make $30,000 for the year. So I was on track to replace everything I had made, you know, at the Apple store, which is great. I mean, that's a good sign. I'm a year out. Like, things have changed. I've got this proof that I can do this for this first year. But the interesting thing was, now that I'm a year into this, the honeymoon phase is starting to wear off. And so I get to this point, you know, it's the end of summer, it's starting to get cooler, that, you know, sort of winter blues start to fall into place. And, you
know, vitamin D.
Yeah. So as the summer's kind of slowly coming to an end, I get this call out of the blue from two people that I went to school with. We actually weren't really friends in school. We just kind of knew of each other.
James Madison?
Yeah, yeah. So two acquaintances that I had had kind of met in school. They were in the same program as me, so we knew of each other.
Gotcha.
And I kind of forget how it started, but, you know, they just kind of reached out, wanted to connect with, you know, someone else who was in the industry and in the area. And they started telling me, like, you know, we just went on this retreat. And I'm like, what do you mean? Like, yeah. What? They're like, you know, we found out about this group of people that were tired of where they were in life and truly wanted to move forward. And not in this slow, you know, slow and steady wins the race kind of way. I mean, we wanted like a drastic transformation.
Jumpstart. Right.
And we went away on this retreat with this organization, and it blew our minds, you know. And they start to tell me more about what this is. And I'm like, this kind of sounds like where, like, I'm hearing where they were before they went on the trip.
Right.
And I'm like, this kind of sounds like where I'm at right now, is I just like really felt purposeless. It's like, okay, like, I did the business. I made it successful. Now what? Like, what do I do next? Do I have to do this for the next 40 years? Is it just going to be the same thing all over again? And so I'm kind of trying to figure it all out. Like, I almost had lost my meaning because I had achieved the goal that I set out to do.
Okay.
And now it was like, there's nothing left.
Huh.
I mean, there was, don't get me wrong, but right. Like, I couldn't see it at that point in time.
Right. Okay.
So I got there and I'm just like, you know, you set the bar to a certain point. What happens when you hit the bar? The bar continues to move up. It goes somewhere else. And now you've got to hit this higher bar. But for me, like, I had set the bar, and then it never went any higher. So when I got there, I was like, what's up with this? You know, right, like, right. What's going on? And, you know, they're telling me more and more about this retreat. And finally, I decided I need to apply for this. It was called the Higher Purpose Project. And it's run by some fantastic people. And, you know, I got in. I've scrounged up the money between asking my mom for like an early birthday present, my grandparents for some help financially, to go on this retreat. And we spent 4 days up in Boston. They rented out this campground in the middle of the Berkshires. And it's just gorgeous. I mean, we're living in these like junky bunk beds that they use for a summer camp, but it's kind of like in this cabin house with like a den area and couches. And like, we had fresh cooked like organic meals in the cafeteria. Yeah. And then there's this gorgeous lake. It's like a mile wide lake, and there's a dock, and you can take out paddle boards and just.
What was the group size?
It was probably 20-ish people, maybe 25.
So it's not too many.
No, it wasn't. It wasn't that big. It was like just the right amount where I could truly connect and get to meet every single person. Cool. There. And I felt it from the second I had watched their promo video before I'd even signed up. They actually, they use a song by Einaudi called Divineer. And many people have actually probably heard this in other places, but for whatever reason, the emotion that was evoked within me, like before I was even done the video, I knew I had to go. And I remember, you know, flying into Boston and getting there and like meeting the first person who was there. It was my friend Janine, who's now a great friend of mine. She was like hanging out at the airport. And slowly, one by one, you know, everybody files in and we get to meet each other, take the bus ride up to the location. And just, I can't describe with words the vibe that was going on at the time, because I met this guy Kyle on the bus who quickly like turned into like somehow my long lost brother in another life.
Yeah.
You know, he's a videographer too. We were like the same person.
Right.
And I just can't describe in words what I was feeling at that time, other than I knew that if I didn't start to open up right away and just share everything about what I was feeling and who I was and what I was about, I would not get everything out of this trip.
Right.
So I had to just lay it out on the table. I was telling people about my struggle with, you know, suicidal thoughts and depression as a teenager. And it just quickly found over this 2-hour bus ride to where we were going, like my whole life story was just out on the table. And it was just like, here's who I am, like take it or leave it, you know, but like, this is who I am in my full essence, you know, 100% of my being. And I'm just going to see how you guys respond.
How quickly did you come to find, you know, similar stories from everyone else?
Immediately. I mean, the second I started sharing certain aspects of my life of, you know, everything from divorced parents to depression as a teenager to suicidal thoughts to, you know, attempting to take your own life, everybody has gone through it. And it was so wild to me because at that time, you feel like you're the only one and this is only happening to you.
Right.
And here you are on a bus with 20 other people that are like, you don't understand. Like, we are so much more similar than you thought.
Right.
And they had created such a safe environment where we were all able to open up. And it was everything from like, you know, doing morning sunrise yoga on the docks of the lake to these organic lunches to just treating your body holistically and just really opening up your awareness to what you're fully capable of. And I came back from that weekend thinking, like, not even thinking, I knew that my life had changed forever. It would never be the same. I would not be the same person who was on that plane going up to Boston. And
did you have a better idea at this point of how you were going to grow your business because of the Higher Purpose Project?
I don't think that I knew how I was going to grow the business, but it was more of a personal development thing. Like, right. I remember as I'm walking through the security line in the airport when I'm leaving this trip, it was kind of like in Scrubs or those TV shows where you see like the person is stationary and everyone's moving so quickly around them. Yeah. And you're just like, you're in your own world.
Yeah.
I was almost scared to go back to the real world because the last thing we had done was we visited Walden Pond, which is where Henry David Thoreau wrote Walden. And it was all about, you know, going wow. into the woods and the wilderness to like live this lifestyle that was so much simpler.
Right. You're than like, how what can I ever world... go back?
Yeah. I mean, he essentially went off script and like wanted this simple life that nobody else wanted. And so I'm back in this world of like, everyone's on their phone and in a rush and trying to get places in the airport. And I'm like, I'm not the same person going home right now. Like, I am a completely different person. Everything is different from here on out. And I'm sitting on the plane on the way home, and I just knew that every decision I make from here on out is going to be different. But the one thing that I learned while I was on that trip was I had to go to California.
So you finally went to California?
I did. I had made the decision, actually, like, we were hiking up a mountain one day and I'm like mid conversation with somebody and all of a sudden out of nowhere, I was just like, I need to go to California. They're like, what? Like, we were talking about something else entirely. And they're like, what are you talking about? I'm like, you don't understand. Like, we were thinking, you know, we were having a conversation yesterday about what's the one thing that like you're not doing that you need to do right now. You know, was there like something in your gut that you felt you had to do? And it didn't hit me till the next day when we're climbing the mountain. Like, the one thing I always said I was going to do was I was going to go to California. And I never totally knew the goal or why I was going to go out there. But I knew that just the very act of putting myself out there,
right,
something would change in my life.
Right.
And I made the decision. Actually, I was teaching myself travel hacking by reading blogs on Reddit and like watching YouTube videos, and learned that if I took out some credit cards, hit some spending bonuses real quick, I'd have hundreds of thousands of sky miles and I could go for free. So it turned into just, I need to buy a one-way plane ticket to California too. I actually bought a ticket from Baltimore to Denver and hung out with one of my friends I had made from that, two of my friends I had made from that trip in Denver, went to Boulder, actually visited my big brother from the fraternity when I was in college, then flew from Denver to San Francisco. And the best part about it was, you know, one of my friends who was on the trip with us, who was like on this journey too of self-discovery, was like, surprise, I think I'm going to go to San Francisco with you and hang out for the week.
Wow.
I'm like, cool, let's do it. So we got to like explore San Francisco, visited a fraternity brother at Facebook headquarters, got to see Mark Zuckerberg in his office.
What?
Just like the whole trip was wild. Rented a car, drove Highway 1, just like did everything.
Cool.
And left San Francisco. My friend went back home. I went to LA, and then I went from LA on to Dallas, and then Dallas back home over the course of a month.
Wow.
And there was never really a deadline of when I was going to come home. It was just kind of open to whenever I felt like it was right to go home, I was going to do it.
You put the business on pause?
Yeah. And the crazy part is, like, before I bought that plane ticket, that voice came in the back of my head of, like, you're screwing this up again. It was like that same voice of, like, why did you just invest $11,000 in a coach? Came back and was like, you're about to mess this up again. You're about to throw everything away that you worked so hard for. What are you doing? And it was that inner monologue that was like playing devil's advocate, but on the negative side. And I kind of just ignored it and said, you know what? I need to just figure this out. And I think I remember talking to my dad about it a little bit. And he said, you know what? What's the worst that can happen? And it's a little cliche because a lot of people say that.
That is true.
But he kind of brought the point to mind that this is the only time in my life where I don't have a wife, I don't have kids,
mortgage,
I don't have anything holding me back.
Right.
This is the one time I could screw up massively
and
have 40 more years to come back from it.
Right.
I can't do that when I have a wife or kids or a house or anything.
Right.
And that's where I really knew. That was my confirmation. That was the first time a family member was like, this is exactly where you need to be and what you need to do, and supported it.
That must have been an amazing feeling.
It was a pretty big eye opener.
Yeah.
And the crazy part about it was I got the travel bug. So like I got home from that month long trip, and then next thing you know, I'm like home doing a little bit of work for a few weeks.
Antarctica.
Because not Antarctica, not yet. That's on the list. But you know, I caught up. So like, you know, I was on this trip thinking like, dude, you're screwing this up. You're not going to make money. You're going to come back to nothing. And I forgot that like I had my laptop with me. I had my phone. I was like answering incoming client emails. I actually booked $6,000 worth of work from the road in advance and just said, hey, I can do this in like 4 weeks. I'm just not home right now.
Right.
And took the deposit. So I get home like, wait a second, I made $6,000 and I wasn't even here, you know? So that's where it was like, okay, started to shift the awareness.
Right.
You know, the circle of awareness grew bigger. And so I came home, did some work, and Christmas is rolling around. And at this point in time, I'm single. So over that past summer, I had broken up that relationship. I'm single. My roommate, who's my cousin, is single. He's only a year older than me. We're looking for something fun to do. Like, what did two single guys do on Christmas Eve? Naturally, they go get Chinese food. But I convinced him to go get Chinese food and continue on to a 3,000-mile road trip.
Oh, my.
So he, because of the amount of days in between Christmas and January 1st, he could take off just like 1 or 2 days of work, and he was good for that whole time span. And we left on Christmas Eve. We got Chinese food. We drove up to Pittsburgh that night. I used some rewards points to buy a hotel room, and that was the last hotel room we ever stayed in for the rest of that trip.
Wow.
Because we moved our way past Pittsburgh on Christmas Day to got to give a shout out to Suzanne Schaefer here and the family, because Suzanne and her husband had an automotive company that had been learning from the marketing company that I was originally employed by fresh out of college.
Right.
And so I met them at conferences, been friends with
them. Really coming full circle.
Yeah. And so we're driving through Indianapolis and I like put a feeler out on Facebook. I'm like, do I know anyone in Indy who can like give us a couch to crash on tonight? And next thing you know, she's like making us dinner. We're hanging out with her kids. We're watching a movie. Just like, it was awesome. She awesome. Like kicked her daughter out of her own room for the night so we could have a bed to sleep in. So Suzanne, I'm sorry you had to do that, but thanks. Like, gotta give you some credit there. You guys were awesome.
Give the daughter credit too.
Like, I can't think of like a more generous family who just like took us in with open arms and was like, this is amazing what you guys are doing.
Yeah.
What can we do to help you? And, you know, we were just like, literally, we need nothing but a bed to sleep in for the night.
Right. Where'd you go from Indiana?
So Indiana, we started to loop down. So, you know, we went out through Ohio and Indianapolis, and then we looped down through
Missouri or...
Yeah. I remember we stopped in Louisville, Nashville, and then ultimately Nashville and Louisville to Atlanta, all the way down to Jacksonville.
Oh,
so
wow,
we kind of
cool.
like curved all the way down to Florida. We stayed in Louisville with a fraternity brother. In Nashville, I think we were just passing through. I think we actually made it all the way to Atlanta.
Cool.
And we stayed at an Airbnb.
Nice.
Which was a unique experience. We got there kind of late at night, and we got hit on by the male Airbnb host who took us out for barbecue and then invited us to his hot tub later that night for some... Yeah, we didn't partake, but, you know, adventures in the life of Zeffin. It's just all another piece of the journey.
Airbnb was, like, probably a new concept at that time,
too. It was, like, brand new, and so I was, like, all about it because, you know, I signed up and got, like, a $25 off code or something. So I was like, we got to do this. Like, we're cheap. We have no money. Let's just figure it out.
Right.
And we ultimately wound up in an Airbnb after that in Jacksonville, Florida. And this was kind of our halfway point. You know, we wanted to, like, take a break from driving. So we spent, like, 2 days there. And I remember it was this small apartment on the beach. We walked, like, 10 miles on the beach. It's 90 degrees outside. We had been in, like, you know, rainy Pittsburgh a few days prior. And we're just loving it, being on the beach, just enjoying everything. The food, just being in the sun, just being there.
Did you ever think, hey, I would love to move to Jacksonville at this point? You know, this is, it's got a great vibe, whatever.
Yeah, I mean, we didn't really get to see much of the city because we really just kind of stayed on the beach and the restaurants. But like for us, we were so excited that it's the middle of winter in Baltimore. So it's, you know, 20 degrees outside back home.
Right.
And we're like laying out on the beach.
Yeah.
And the cool thing, and this was where we started to realize that the world is very, it's such a small place, was we're hanging out at night with our Airbnb host. She's like, hey, you know, I've got a friend coming over tonight. We're probably going to have some drinks and just hang out.
She does, by the way. Okay.
Yeah, she's got a friend coming over.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
And we're like, cool, you know, we'd love to meet more people. Like, we're really just kind of going along with the adventure and wherever it took us. And so we're hanging out that night, just talking. And this girl's like, oh, where are you guys from? I'm like, from Maryland. She said, what part? I'm like, Baltimore. And she goes, no, like, what part? Because if you're from Baltimore, like, there's many different smaller towns within Baltimore. Like, I'm from Pikesville. And so she, like... She says, you know, what part? No, really, tell me. And we're like, oh, we're from Pikesville. And she goes, oh, no way. My boyfriend went to Boys Latin High School. And we're like, that's a private school, like 10 minutes down the street.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
We're in Florida, a stranger's house that we met on Airbnb. Her friend just happened to come over and she knows the neighborhood that we live in. Like, she knew the street name. She knew the bagel place up the street. Like, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
So like halfway into this trip, we're like, the world is officially a very small place.
I had that happen to me 6 months ago. I was in LA and I talking to some guy randomly at a restaurant, and he was from Pikesville.
Yeah. It happens. It totally happens.
Yeah. All right. So you went on a 4-day trip with the Higher Purpose Project, and this led to this journey across the U.S. How do other people do this? Because it sounds awesome.
You know, I feel like this is the unanswerable question, right? Like, this
I need
is
an answer. I need an answer.
This is the place that so many people get stuck in. And, you know, everyone seems to have one way or the other for looking at it. And so, like, I've got to start off by just sharing a quick quote from an interview that I had with David Mead on my podcast, who's a member of Simon Sinek's team.
A couple other things that I can throw in there just as a couple of tips is every decision that you make will either get you closer to your why or farther away from it. So when you're going to make a career decision, or when you're going to make a decision to hire somebody, or you're going to make a decision to partner with somebody, always go back to your why and use it as a filter and ask yourself the question, is this decision going to get me one step closer to the world I imagine or one step farther away from it? So just start using your why as a filter for every decision that you make.
So, you know, if there was a formula, I'd totally give it to you, but everyone's journey is going to be different. And I just want to jump over and share a little bit of a different insight from John Lee Dumas.
Sure.
He's over on the Entrepreneur on Fire podcast. And here's just a little tidbit from my interview with him.
It's a very hard journey. I like to equate it to a marathon, not a sprint. You know, that's what we're on right now. We are on a marathon, and that's good, because there's a quote that I love that's by Earl Nightingale, which is success and happiness is a gradual realization of a worthy ideal. You know, having this goal that's here and then reaching it, like, that's good, but that's not gonna be sustained happiness, because now, like, okay, what's next? So having this gradual realization of a worthy ideal over this marathon of life, that's what excites me.
All right, so I can see where this is tough. Some people are implying that it's a part of this journey that you take, right? I mean, you spend time trying out things and seeing what sticks and staying with your happy place, so to speak. But even David said, start to ask yourself the question, is this decision going to get me one step closer to the world that I imagine or one step farther away from it? How do you go about defining that world and that mental space that you want to live in?
So this is a great question, and it's really what my book, Life Rescripted, covers. So how about I'm going to take you through some of the story of how I decided to rescript my own life, because a big part of this adventure and this travel hacking and working my way around the world, you know, we could probably pull some lessons out of this and just sharing, you know, this new reality that I created for myself and designing your future through your story.
Sure.
So, I mean, before this trip even happened, I actually took those 12 steps again that I used to build the business and looked at, okay, like, I know I need to get to California. Where do these steps break down in between? Because I don't necessarily have the money to spend. I still felt strapped for cash, even though the business was doing okay. Because I sat there and I was like, you know, I could fail. I could put the business on hold and just the business could be gone and up and poof. You know, I leave for a month and it's gone.
Right.
So I had to figure out some sort of way of doing this. And so, you know, I started researching online. I kind of heard of this idea of travel hacking and how people use credit cards and hit the bonus spends where they would spend like $3,000 in the first 3 months and they get like 100,000 sky miles.
I see. Yeah.
So having a relatively decent credit score, I took out like 4 or 5 cards and there I was with like 500,000 sky miles, because I had found ways to essentially spend the money on the credit card to hit that spending bonus.
Right.
And I would put it essentially onto like a Visa gift card.
Yeah.
And then use the Visa gift card to pay off the bill of the credit card. Now, this was much easier at the time. The rules have kind of changed, but it was super easy for me to rack up a couple hundred thousand sky miles in a few weeks.
Wow.
And so my new reality was kind of writing itself, because I took those 12 steps and I was like, okay, like, here I am here at the bottom at the zero, and the 30,000 at the top is me in California,
you know,
or on a plane to California. Yeah, How do I get there? And so it really meant, you know, let's find a way to do it that doesn't just mean going online and booking the ticket right now. Like, let's figure out creatively how we can do this in a different way, you know, and look at it through a different lens.
Right.
And for me, that meant, you know, I had heard of this one thing somewhere. I read an article, started researching it, breaking down the steps of, okay, step one, got to take out a credit card. Step two, got to do this. Step three, got to spend money on the card.
Right.
Step four, you get the bonus points when you hit that spending limit. So, you know, it really just broke it back down to those 12 steps. And, you know, that led me through that trip for roughly a month around the country, and then ultimately getting the travel bug and just having to go on that road trip with my cousin. And, you know, we're down in Florida in Jacksonville. We're at our halfway point. We ultimately worked our way back up through Charleston, North Carolina, stayed in another Airbnb while we were there, stayed with my buddy, my college roommate in Virginia Beach on New Year's Eve.
Awesome. Love it. You're a videographer, right? Super wild. Was there any thought in your mind that you want to make this into a movie? You bring the camera along with you on this journey. Did that happen?
I actually bought a GoPro and a little like gimbal stabilizer, and I have like video footage outside of, I think we were outside of the Colts stadium. Yeah. And my cousin Dan is failing to do the limbo underneath one of those parking guards things that closes the parking garage. And then we're like running up the stairs in front of the stadium. He's like running around just filming me. Like, we totally have some footage of the trip. You know, it's not like super high quality or anything like fancy, but like there, I feel like that need was definitely underneath of it all to want to document this trip, to want to show people, you know, what can happen when you just let go and just go for it. So it certainly was there, but nothing hit me as hard as it did when I got home, because, you know, we spent New Year's Eve in Virginia Beach. We actually had bought some illegal fireworks in Louisville that were still in the trunk. And so we're in Virginia Beach. We decide at like 11 o'clock at night on New Year's Eve, we just want to drive out to the middle of nowhere and blow up all these illegal fireworks. We actually wound up getting the car stuck in a muddy ditch. So it's like 2 o'clock in the morning and AAA is like towing us out of some muddy ditch in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
And the next morning, you know, it was in our plan to drive home. It was New Year's Day, you know, cousin had to get back to work, and just kind of decided the trip had run its course. And we're driving home. And, you know, he's trying to convince me we should stop in DC to go to the Spy Museum. And he's like, come on, I'm going to buy tickets on my phone right now. And I'm like, that's fine, but I'm not stopping. Like, we're going home.
Right.
And, you know, we get home, and the first thing in my mind is like, back to civilization. Like, let's jump on Facebook. Let's see where people are at, what's going on. And literally at the top of the newsfeed, someone that I know who I'm connected with shared an article, and it just said, 2016 or 2015 to be a year of purpose for many people. And I see this article, and, you know, little did we know what was going to happen next, because we had no idea what was going to happen.
And I mean, did you have any negative talk, self-limiting talk in your, you know, in your head at this point, or was that all eradicated?
I mean, I certainly came back to that place of like, here you go again, like, you've been on the road, you're wasting your business away, you're not being productive, you're not working on it. But it wasn't as strong as before, because I had that realization of, you know, I had that understanding that I was on the road and built $6,000 a month.
Right.
You know, so I knew it wasn't impossible, but it definitely wasn't the same being gone that time. Like, I didn't make the same amount of money, but I was only gone for, it was like 10 days or something.
Right.
It's amazing that when you think you're going to die in that last moment, you can see so many things. You have so total clarity on what your life was about and what you did in your life.
When we tell ourselves we're not good enough, we're, why me? I'm this race, so thus I don't have these opportunities. Those are all lazy. That's lazy talk. And I know I'm offending people, and I apologize, and we'll tie this all in, but that's lazy talk. That's you giving in to a reality that isn't the reality that exists in the actual world.
Yeah. And I always, absolutely, I always say that, you know, positive thinking doesn't solve your problems, you know, but it puts you in a peak physical, mental, and emotional state to solve your own problems. And that's really what it is, you know.
So let's shift into the podcast.
Yeah. So, I mean, I see this article, and something clicked. I had been, for the last year, just in this self-improvement mode, you know, want to be an entrepreneur and just be this awesome all-around guy.
Right.
So I had been listening to two podcasts in particular. I've been listening to Brendan Burchard, Live, Love, Matter.
Yeah, love
and
it.
I had been listening to The Art of Charm, because single, want to, like, learn how I can find a relationship,
right.
And, you know. So, like, I remember, like, my nights recovering from coming home from the gym, I'd have, like, an Epsom salt bath and just tune into, like, a 30-minute episode of Art of Charm. And so, like, Jordan Harbinger was, like, the soundtrack of my, like, workout recovery. And I I had kind of thought it would be cool to start a podcast. It wasn't like 100% like I just got back and decided let's do it. But I hung on those words year of purpose because I related so much to it for the next couple days. And I started to think, you know, how cool would it be if I did a podcast? What would I do a podcast on? And then like the words came back to me like, year of purpose podcast. Why not? Like this has been the journey I've been on the last 2 or 3 months is right. Like, I want to find my purpose. I want to know why I'm here and how I'm going to make my impact on the world. And I'm kind of figuring things out as I go and I'm getting a taste of it. Like, why not do what all the greats did? You know, if you look at How to Win Friends and Influence People and all these books, Napoleon Hill, these people, they surrounded themselves and interviewed and learned from other people.
Data.
So it made sense is, okay, let's go and find people that are creating life on their own terms, that are doing exactly what they want to do, that love every day of it,
right?
And interview them to find out how they got there.
Yeah.
And it actually started, the first person I ever interviewed was Adam Smiley Pozwalski. He authored a book called The Quarter Life Breakthrough. He was only a couple years older than me, and congrats to him. He actually just launched his book because Penguin picked it up and he republished it. Yeah. So he self-published first and then he republished it. And I mean, it's growing like wildfire now.
Oh, I know. I read it. I love it. I love it.
So, I mean, it just, that was a huge piece of taking that leap. I actually met him when I was in San Francisco. And so kind of having that in the back of my head, I felt it was only natural to ask him to be the first podcast interview.
How much prep work did you put in to forming the podcast idea before you reached out to him?
About 2 weeks. So like the idea came, you know, January 1st.
I think you execute quick.
Oh, yeah. I jumped on it. I think I was reading hours and hours every day. What mic do I need to use? You know, I had equipment because I was a videographer. So I had some mics. You know, how do I record this interview? What do I need? You know, what software? Mm-hmm. Where do I upload this? Just I learned everything. It goes back to that whole like 12-step formula of just like, here's your zero, here's your 30,000.
Right.
Figure out what's in between.
Right.
You know, and if those 12 steps aren't broken down enough, where you break it down again.
Right.
You know, that $2,500 a month wasn't enough for me. So I had to break it down to what do I need to do on a day-to-day basis.
Right.
Same thing goes for all this stuff. Like, I can't tell you that I knew what those 12 steps were in between, but I can find out.
Right. Yeah.
You know, we live in a world where you can learn how to tie a tie on YouTube.
Yeah.
You know, we're in a place where it's like there's no excuse for not learning something.
Okay, so you're getting a podcast off the ground. No more excuses. It's go time, et cetera, et cetera. At this point in your life, you've only really started your year of purpose. So what were your thoughts on the time of death? What about legacy? What were you going to leave behind at some point, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely a scary thought to me, because I started to think more and more about how, you know, we love to have control in this world. We love to be able to control our destiny, our fate, and everything that's going on. But truthfully, there's nothing that's stopping, you know, me from being in a car accident on the way home.
Right.
Like, we don't have control over how long we're actually here. You know, if we're the lucky ones, live to 90 or 100 and live out a fantastic life. Mm-hmm. But you know what? There's so many people, and it's just, this is how this world is some people aren't that lucky. And so, you know, I'm talking to others, my awareness bubble is increasing even more. I'm being introduced to people from around the world that have taken life by the horns and really just, you know, done it up big. And I'm starting to notice this pattern of like every single one of these people wanted to leave something behind, but also wanted to know that if this were their last day, that they were satisfied, you know, with where they were at, that, you know, their family would really honor what they did and how hard they worked
right.
for it.
Yeah.
And so I truly wanted to emulate that. So I started interviewing people sometimes twice a week. I would release episodes and, you know, hired a booking service to, you know, book people on my podcast and hook me up with people that I might not otherwise be able to get in touch with. And, you know, the podcast quickly grew. That spring into summer, I actually decided to go to the Podcast Movement conference. And that was out in Dallas, Fort Worth. Got to stay at my friend Judy's house. Just because, you know, it's great when you have a friend there and you can stay somewhere and not have to pay for a hotel.
Right. Yeah.
So of course, huge shout out to Judy, but you know, I'm learning about podcasts and just meeting everyone in the hallways and like, next thing you know, like Pat Flynn is calling me out from the crowd in his keynote speech in front of 1,100 people. So you guys,
what'd
heard,
that feel like?
I mean, you guys heard that at the beginning of this episode. Like, it just, I had no clue. I was actually, for whatever reason, like, I don't know why I would never even like ignore Pat Flynn, because I want to hear like every word he's saying. But for some reason at this point in his talk, I was like looking at my phone or just like looking something up, and I get a text from my buddy John, and it just says, "Dude, look up, you're on the screen." And I'm like, "What?" You know, like, "Huh?" And I look up, and it's a picture of me and Pat on the screen, and he's like talking about me and sharing my story of how I like wrote to him when I lost my job at GKIC and told him, you know, about like how I was taking the leap of faith and starting my own business. I'm like,
yeah,
oh my gosh. Yeah. I mean, just too many feelings to even explain what I was feeling at the time. But it's so unbelievable what happens when you just truthfully and honestly open up and share your story with someone that inspired you, and, you know, thank them or just tell them what the impact that they had on you, because that's why they're doing it. You know, he wants to impact the lives of that many people, and to share that with him and not just be another face in the crowd, it was just a fantastic experience. And actually, like, I was on my way out of the hotel that day getting ready to head back, and someone drags me to the side and is like, "We're doing a smart passive income meetup at this bar. You should come check it out." And like the second I walk in the door, like Pat walks in behind me and goes, "Hey man, I'm really sorry. I didn't warn you. I was going to call you out from the audience like that. Like, I'm really sorry. I hope it's okay." And I'm like,
"Yeah, don't do it again."
Okay. It's more than okay. Like, what? Yeah. Like, I had no clue you were going to do that. That was fantastic. Like, everyone was coming up to me for the rest of the conference. Like, "You're that guy."
Yeah.
And like, that was never my plan. It was never my intention. Like, sure, I want to network and meet tons of people, but like, he knew what he was doing. He knew that that would change the story plot for the rest of my life of where I was going.
How many episodes into the podcast are you at this point?
So if the podcast started in January, you know, I was probably, I don't know, like 30 or 40 episodes.
Oh, so you're pretty deep. You weren't just like,
yeah, it was about a third of the way.
Right. It wasn't like right off the bat. You weren't 2, 3, 4 episodes in.
Yeah, no, This was not brand new. And he invited me while he was there to be a guest on his show many months later. But like, he, on that spot, he was like, "Hey, here's my card. Send me an email. Like, let's get you on the show." So I couldn't imagine what was going to happen after that point. I mean, it just, the year was fantastic. I actually interviewed a guy by the name of Chandler Bolt, who taught self-publishing school, and he teaches people how to become best-selling authors. And when I interviewed him on the episode, I'm like thinking, just like, "Oh, that's kind of, I'd like to be a best-selling author. It'd be cool to be an author, right? Like, write a book, you know, you never know what could happen with it." And so like, it was just this idea in my mind in like, you know, April or May, but over the summer I joined his program. I started writing the book throughout that year. And by like November-ish of that year, Life Rescripted was done. Like, I had a printed copy in hand and was like planning out my book launch party, and it was
executing
a wild
quick again.
Yeah, I mean, it was a wild year to go from New Year's Day, you're coming home from this wild road trip, you still really have no idea where your business is going to go, but you're starting this passion project on the side, which is the podcast, to, you know, halfway through the year, you start writing a book, which, by the way, I was diagnosed with a learning disability in school. I could read a whole book and not remember any of it. So for that kid to grow up and go write a book, you know, I'm not the next, greatest writer, but the fact that I just completed it, that I just did it, it's not perfect. I know it's probably got a couple spelling errors, and I don't really care because I did it. You know, it was the fact that I brought myself out of bed every morning and took myself to the computer to write and to do it.
I talk to a lot of creatives, whether they're musicians or videographers, photographers or writers, whatever, who come from a linear career path and jump and follow their heart, whatever, and jump into this creative pool, right? At any point with any of these endeavors of yours, it sounds like you never had this "I'm faking" feeling. It sounds like you got the idea, you executed, you followed that up by surrounding yourself with people that were strong believers in what you were doing, learned how to do it, and bam, done.
Yeah, I mean,
I meet a lot of people. I'm just saying, I meet a lot of people who begin to write and they put out something and they're just like, I'm not a writer, or, you know, like, or for example, I start a podcast, but I'm not a guy that does podcasts, but they're doing it, or, you know, whatever. Did you ever feel like that along the way?
I mean, I think the funny part is it hit me when I quote unquote made it, like after the book had been done and out and hit bestseller and the podcast had been out for a year and my business was successful. Like, it wasn't until I checked off all the boxes that I was like sitting there thinking, like, who am I to get the credit for accomplishing this? Like, who am I to speak to the thousands of people that listen to the podcast and be that role model for them? And it's very odd that it hit me at that point in time, because most people would hit it like along the way up, you know, and they would cut it. For some reason, it had just, I tuned it out. I don't know. It wasn't in my mind. But certainly after I had accomplished many of those things, it definitely hit me. And I remember writing an email to my list saying, like, I feel like I'm a fake.
After you have achieved all this.
After I had achieved it. And it wasn't fake. I mean, look, I sat there and wrote that book. Like, it's not like someone else wrote it. Yeah. It's not like it was copied from anywhere. Like, I made it.
It's funny that you would feel like that with the proof in your hand.
Yeah. I think partially because I had an audience now. And I had people that depended on me and looked to me for answers and looked to me to give them input and feedback and, you know, to be the role model. And, you know, I'm in my 20s. Like, it's not like I've lived this long life of screw-ups and mistakes and successes. Like, who am I to be this young guy to set the example for people that might be even older than me?
Why not?
I mean, that's probably why I'm still going.
Obviously, from everything you just told me, life got super busy for you. Podcast. Are you in Life Rescripted at this point? Are you beginning to write, or you?
So I wrote it over the summer of 2015.
Okay. So ZMB, podcast, beginning to write, Life is Rescripted. I mean, successful business. Your relationships were on fire at this point, professional and personal.
I was still single. I was actually single for the longest.
Were you dating,
span of time?
Were you dating? Were you testing the waters at that point?
The funny thing was, it like wasn't even a thought in my mind. I had been so focused on the business and the self-improvement, so I kind of put it off for a year or two.
I mean, you're running a podcast. You have success. You had a successful business going. Your relationships were on fire. How do you balance everything? I mean, isn't there like, there's got to be a breaking point, right?
You don't sleep. No, I mean, I certainly, I think that whole trip with like Higher Purpose, and then like that whole trip that I had built out for myself had me so on fire, mm-hmm. that it was just like, I felt untouchable. You know, I was in the best fitness shape, physical fitness shape of my life. You know, personally, I felt good. You know, I woke up in the morning ready to go. And I think it's because I had ignited that passion side of things. I had been so focused on the business for so long, but I never had that thing that like kept me going outside of that. You know, when the laptop shuts closed for the day, it was like there was nothing left. But now with the podcast, I had this like renewed sense of like, now there's something that I'm really here for outside of the work, and I can impact even more people than just the one client who's hired me.
Yeah.
And, you know, it really got to a point where, you know, in 2013, I had to replace that $15,000 just to get by, right? To hit that $30,000 goal for the year. 2014, I doubled that. I made $30,000 for the year. 2015, I doubled that again. I made $60,000 a year. Mm-hmm. And here I am in 2016 on track to make a lot more than I made last year. So I was on fire from the productivity standpoint.
Right.
But I think part of it was that I had certainly made a sacrifice in not being interested in
relationships.
A relationship.
Right.
Now, my friendships were great. My friendships were totally there. And I think I was relying on them for so long to help me get by, because my friends loved to see me succeed. Of course, like anyone would be happy for their friend who's succeeding. So I was like running off of that fuel. But it certainly got to a point where I discovered that entrepreneurship can be a very lonely thing. And I discovered that when I actually met someone by the name of Simon Smart. And I interviewed him on we did a virtual summit. We interviewed like 41 or 42 people over a summer and launched it out to, you know, bring people in to just get to know more about me, my story, and everyone that I was interviewing on the podcast. And Simon talks about going into this warrior's mindset of thinking and just having a truly sound, like, samurai style mindset. And after that interview, he was like, you know, I don't know how we're going to work together, but I can tell you, I can feel it. At some point in the future, you and I are going to link up. And I don't know what it is yet, but it's going to happen. And going into the end of 2015, I actually, you know, he reached back out again. It's like, how's everything going? And he's like, I've got this, I want to just jump on a call. And he sat there and he listened to everything going on in my life, you know, for like 40 minutes straight, just me just puking everything out of what was going on. Because right. As much as the success was good and the highs were high, he was also tuning in and hearing where the lows were and the things that I was avoiding and the things that I wasn't talking about, mm-hmm. and was calling them out.
Mm, yeah.
And to which point he ultimately invited me to come out to a transformative experience in Arizona with him and a couple other guys. And I'm thinking, you know, like I did something like this before. I did Higher Purpose Trip, and that was a year ago. That was right around when I had hired my coach. So like I hadn't had a coach in like a year, and I was starting to feel a little lost. Like the success was there, the business was there, the podcast was going, but I still wasn't totally sure where things were at. And I was like, you know, I'm probably overdue for, you know, a nice kick in the butt. Mm-hmm. And he invited me out, went out to Arizona for Warrior Protocol training. And I'll never forget, you know, I don't want to share the whole experience with everyone because I think this is definitely one of those experiences where, like, to each their own, like, you actually get to, like, have a better experience by keeping it as a part of you and not telling everyone the full story.
Right.
But there certainly was a part where I jumped in a boxing ring. It was very workout related. A lot of this was very physically taxing.
Right.
But at one point, I jumped in a boxing ring, and I had never been in a boxing ring before. And you know, put on the mask, the protective mask, and put on the gloves, and you know, they wrapped up my hands, and was put into a match with one of the guys that was in our group. And you know, I went for a round, got hit a couple times. It hurt. Did okay, but in the second round, I had been battling mentally some things of my past from a long time ago. And in my head, it was coming out, but I was holding back from sharing it with them that I was going through it. And the second I got distracted, I let my guard down. I got knocked out. Just hit square in the face, fell down to the floor.
Wow.
And like everything went fuzzy for a little bit. And, you know, I kind of like come to and ultimately get up, and I literally felt like that negative self-talk, that negative emotion, those things that had been still eating me up inside for so long were like knocked out of me almost. So I think that also plays a big role. And, you know, when you ask, like, did you feel like you were a fake? Like, I think part of that comes from the negative voice and those things that still eat you up that are totally unrelated.
Right.
That it's those pieces that show you that you're not perfect. And I almost felt like that was literally knocked out of me that night.
Yeah.
And I'm not telling people to go jump in a boxing ring and get punched in the face, but
we should note you were also fighting Mike Tyson.
Right. But like, I think it's important to mention how transformative experiences can be when you take on a coach, when you take a risk, when you take a leap, when you trust in others who have been there, who have done that, and who can show you or open a door to the next place that you're going to go to. Because there's no way for us to know where we're going, you know, unless you're on a roller coaster. It stays on the track, you know exactly where it goes. It goes up, it goes down, it goes around, it comes back into the station exactly where you started. But life is not going to be like that. Yeah, the twists and the turns, the ups, the downs, but life is never going to come back to the same exact place
right.
from where you started. You will never come back the same person. you know, maybe if you threw up on the roller coaster, you don't come back the same person. But like, you know, let's hope that doesn't happen. But, so I think it's really worth mentioning and giving some huge credit there to being self-aware enough to know when you need to bring on a mentor, when you need to open up to a group of like-minded individuals, when you should go on these retreats or take on these coaches, you know, because I don't think that I would be where I am had it not been me taking that risk and trusting other people to help me along the way.
Prior to you going on this Warriors retreat, was there a breaking point? I'm going to turn to your interview with Rick Martinez.
There's no doubt that sometimes we miss out on the most important things because we're so busy focused on other important things.
And here's a clip from your interview with Chanel and Steve-O from How Far From Home, and also some insight from your interview with Jordan Harbinger.
For creative people, the one thing I think that stood for us was the freedom to experiment and do whatever you want. And you know, we saw Stefan, he did some incredible projects in Bali, and he just got to do anything he wanted. There was no client brief, there was no deadline, well, of course, besides the year, but, you know, you just have complete freedom. And for us, that is the unicorn that we're after, you know?
Yeah. And that stuff piles up, you know, if you don't have the help you need and you don't have your own time scheduled out, you will run into these weird blocks and you won't know what caused it. Or you'll go, well, it was just this, and then I scheduled my email and then this call ran late and then ... my whole day is ruined.
Yeah, so that's Jordan Harbinger. He's from the Art of Charm podcast. And, you know, that's actually one of the first podcasts I started listening to way back when. You know, I was really getting in shape and was working out in the gym, you know, maybe 3, 4, sometimes 5 days a week. My trainer, Jeff, was, you know, conveniently my roommate, and he was getting me into strongman lifting. We had been following this guy, John Anderson, who teaches his deep water method for working out. And all I can say is it just, you know, it left you in so much pain each night. So like each night, you know, I was saying before, I soak in those Epsom salt baths. I tune in to the Art of Charm podcast. You know, this was back before I even had a relationship. So like, I'm interested in learning how to be a better guy, you know, how to attract love and ultimately live a good life.
It's one crazy journey, I tell you. Let me bring in Mitch Matthews of Dream, Think, Do. Here's one thing he said.
You know, I've had some peaks and valleys. I've had what I call bridge jobs, which are those jobs that get you from one place to the next, but just kind of like a bridge. You wouldn't want to live there. You can appreciate a bridge for what it is, but it's not a home, right? I've had some bridge jobs. And when you're in those bridge jobs, you want to focus on what you can learn, what you can earn, and who you can meet, all of those things.
So was this your purpose idea of like a forever thing? I mean, much of like what Mitch said, you don't want to live there, but you appreciate the bridge that gets you to the next place. So what came next? I mean, how did 2016 play out for you?
Yeah, so it's quite interesting, you know, going into the end of 2015, you know, not having thought about a relationship for a while, ultimately Christmas Eve, which seems to be some turning point for me, because, you know, that's where we left on our trip the year prior.
Right.
Christmas Eve, you know, I was able to meet someone and start a new relationship. So, you know, going into the new year, I was stronger than I'd ever been because I put so much work into developing myself to the point where I was now open to a relationship because I knew the business was strong. The podcast was strong. I was just passionate about everything and where I was at the time. And, you know, the book was just getting ready to launch at the beginning, you know, like first week of 2016. So 2016 started off in a huge way. You know, I was in a relationship. I was a best-selling author. Business was moving along. Didn't have to worry so much about where money was coming from. You know, checks were coming in.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I actually got offered an opportunity in spring to staff a group trip. So I've been volunteering for 5 years with the youth group that I was in. It's BBYO, B'nai B'rith Youth Organization. And I've been with them for so long that, you know, I was just interested in doing more. And they're like, well, we've got this summer program where all expenses paid. Like, we can send you to Europe with a bunch of kids.
Oh, wow.
And you can just travel around and, you know, see the sites, learn about your Jewish heritage and your history. And it was fantastic. We left, you know, middle of June to the end of July, and we did this crazy 28-day long trip. Started in Italy, went to Vatican City, we went over to Slovenia, then from Italy, we flew out over to London, and we're in London for like a week, and London to France. France, we actually took this overnight ferry boat, like cruise ship, from London to France. And then from France, we went to Bruges, and we ultimately wound up in Amsterdam before we headed home. So it was just like this crazy journey of like, here I go again,
right.
You know, taking a whole month off, like right. Business is going right. On hold. And
like the California trip, right?
But it was the first time where that voice never came in saying, hey, dude, you're messing up again. You know, you're choosing to put the business on hold. Why are you doing that? Like, yeah. It was gone now, because I had learned from so many people that I had interviewed through the podcast and just everyone that I had met that it's like, you just have to live your life. You just have to do what you want to do. And the craziest part about it was, I remember being in a hotel in Paris, and I'm answering emails on my iPad, and I closed a $12,000 project, you know, from 3,000 miles away.
Yeah.
And I'm on my iPad answering emails. And I just kind of used that same strategy that I learned of like, just say, look, like I'm in France right now.
Yeah.
Like I'll be home in a few weeks.
Do well from the road.
So if you're cool, if we don't start tonight, like,
yeah. Yeah.
Then we'll be good. And it was totally insane to realize that, you know, no longer was it just this $5,000 or $6,000 booked while I'm gone, but now double that, and minus the fear of messing up. It's crazy. Like when I just let go of the fear and just went for it, like it's like the world opened up and said, all right, what do you need? We'll give it to you.
Yeah.
And it was just totally insane to see that happen, you know, being in a successful business, building the largest income I'd ever had while being on the road and just enjoying every piece of life.
So you're able to travel the world on someone else's dime, essentially, build your business even further, still run the podcast from thousands of miles away, from across the pond. What happened within a year? What happened within the Year of Purpose community for you this year, 2016, that differs from last year?
Well, you know, we published Life Rescripted. We launched it in January of 2016 to a great success. You know, 4,000 copies were sold to people from New York to Scotland. I actually got an email from Scotland through the summer while I was working with my intern, Alex. You know, we conceived, designed, and developed an adult coloring book series and gratitude journal hybrid book. And we published 3 volumes of it. You know, we bootstrapped, we outsourced, and using all these methods I learned from Tim Ferriss's 4-Hour Work Week, in just like a couple months' time, with me also being on the road on this trip, for under, I think, $300 or $400, we created 3 new books that were adult coloring books combined with this gratitude journal that launched on Amazon, all while I'm on the other side of the planet. And so, I mean, things changed drastically.
Okay, so it sounds like you didn't run into failure too often here, but I just don't want to focus on the positives here. You know, we have to share what goes on inside your head. I mean, it wasn't perfect, right?
Oh, it certainly wasn't. I mean, take Facebook, for example. You know, we live in a world where people think that likes equate to happiness.
Mm.
You know, I did this thing and took a picture of myself on this wild adventure and 100 people liked it. Therefore, you know,
dopamine boost.
I'm being rewarded for showing off to the world, right?
Right.
So, you know, this happens every day. Facebook was never meant for you to one-up people. It was to connect and to share. But, you know, I want to jump into some of my darkest moments. And before I do, here's a quick soundbite from JLD from EO Fire again.
Failure is part of the game. Failure's there every step of the way, and that's okay, as long as you're learning from those failures.
So you see, you know, failure is a big part of it. I think it's more the fact that we don't like to talk about it, right? Like, we only hear about it once in a blue moon, but imagine if a channel could just be on all the time radiating positivity. So, you know, let me take you back to a really dark time in my life. It's something that still peeks out and haunts me, mostly in the winter and the darker months, but it definitely sits on my shoulder and attempts to convince me that I'm a failure. You know, entrepreneurship can be a very lonely place, but the space between our two ears is even lonelier. You know, when I was in 8th grade, I was diagnosed, or I call it labeled now, with bipolar manic depression. You know, I was 13, coming up on my bar mitzvah, dad's Orthodox, mom isn't, switching houses every single day, switching religions practically every 8 hours. It just had a huge impact on me. And it was also the first time that I had experienced death. So within about like a 1 week time span, one of our classmates had taken his own life. So I was told that on Thanksgiving morning, he had taken his own life. Not only had I had a terrible weekend that weekend, because I had gone up to New Jersey to visit my grandparents with my dad and the family. And my one dream goal was, I was a drummer and I wanted to get back for this Battle of the Bands. I was supposed to play with my buddy Ari. We had this band, we were going to play. It was going to be, you know, I was going to be a drummer and rock out. Right. And, you know, because my family observed the Sabbath, we couldn't drive a car until the Sabbath was over and the sun was down on Saturday.
Right.
We ultimately wound up missing this Battle of the Bands that, you know, to a 13-year-old is like the most heartbreaking thing in the world. Then you come back to school on Monday, your classmates committed suicide. Oh. And then like within the next couple of days, someone who had just had dinner at our house like a weekend or two before was in a car accident, wasn't wearing a seatbelt, went straight through the windshield and was gone. And he was my age. So it's not just like someone who was older, had lived their life. I mean, this was someone who was like younger than me.
It affected you. Right.
And so this was the first time where I really kind of learned in eighth grade, like, you are not permanent.
Right.
It was the first time where I just had no clue what I was doing with myself and why I was here. And I wanted to find that meaning. And so I think, you know, that's really where the super ultimate quest for meaning like came out from. But, you know, I kind of rolled into a depression and I stopped going to my classes. I would skip out and go to the nurse's office because I would have anxiety attacks and I couldn't breathe. And it ultimately turned into me being like bedridden because they'd have me on all these antidepressants and anti-anxiety meds that it's like, I was just a zombie, you know, just like could get up and go to the bathroom and go to the fridge. And that was about it. Watch TV. And I just felt so completely useless. And we tried the homeschooling thing. And for some reason, I got lucky. And they let me graduate the eighth grade and move up to high school. I don't know how, because I wasn't doing the work.
Right.
But I think that they saw that through some medication and going to a therapist, like things are starting to turn. And they felt like, okay, like he can go into high school. He's just going to need a little more help. And I got really lucky that they let me do that. And man, it was just really tough. But I remember after a few months of just being in bed and being drugged up, I woke up one morning and I walked to the kitchen where my pills were sitting on the counter, as they always were. And I was like, I got to do something. Like, if I don't change right here, right now, I had like one small, tiny moment of clarity where I was like, if I don't change right here, right now, I'm going to die. Like, if I don't do something, I will find a way to take my own life. So the question is, am I going to do something? And I remember taking the pills and not taking them because my mom had not been like paying attention anymore to make sure that I took them.
Right.
So I took them out of the bottle. I made them disappear, you know, flush them down the toilet or something. But I stopped cold turkey, which I don't recommend to anyone.
Yeah, it's rough.
You know, this is like a very rare case where I chose to do that. And I remember for like the next week, mom would leave for work. I'm like sitting on the kitchen floor with like a butcher knife, just like bawling my eyes out, thinking like, am I going to do this? Is this it? You know, am I really here? And this is what I'm going to do. And I had that battle in my head of like, you know, there's more than this, but it was that same battle of like literally the knife's in my hands. Like I'm here at this moment, this pivotal moment of like people are dying around me. Life's not permanent. Why should I keep going? You know, like, because, you know, and I think learning about death at such a young age like that, too, like, it's scary. You know, as you're older, you don't think about it. It's like just a natural part of life. It's it's the circle of life, you know, and it just it happens and you ultimately come to accept it. But at 13, you know, my thinking was like, man, that's really going to suck to die and not be here and not be breathing. Like you almost think it's going to be painful to not exist.
Right.
And I felt like I wanted to die. I felt like the better thing to do would have been like, just let's get it done with already. And for some reason, you know, I felt like I had you know, the power in my mind to lift me out of that. So, you know, I have to bring up Chanel again from How Far From Home, because she said, our rule is if it enhances your experiences,
then it's worth it. Everything else you don't need. So
how do we create this magical change in our own lives?
That's a really good question.
I don't think we wake up just one day and go, boom, I'm going to do, you know, something extraordinary. I think extraordinary happens organically and over time. And I think people rush to the extraordinary, and they don't enjoy all of the milestones and landmarks along the way. I myself in a lot of situations to where I was able to strengthen my mental fortitude and get stronger as a person and an individual, as an athlete. And then every one of those experiences and hard things that I experienced would add to it. And then at a certain point in time, I was ready to do it. And so absolutely, there's no goal that's not attainable. What people need to realize is you have to have the appropriate time frame associated with such big goals. And you have to be willing to do the right things consistently over a long period of time.
To me, you know, life is school. We're here to grow a soul. And, you know, nothing should really get in the way of maximizing our potential as much as we can.
So that first piece was by James Lawrence, the Iron Cowboy. You interviewed him on the show right after he broke the Guinness World Record and completed 50 Ironman races in 50 consecutive days in 50 different states. For those who don't know, the Ironman race is a 2.4-mile swim, 112-mile bike ride, and a 26.2-mile run. That's insane. Then the second part came from Michael Mojaluski, who was a correspondent for Outdoor Life TV and has visited over 30 countries, published numerous books, and even shared a story on your podcast about his encounter with a bear and living dateless on an island away from civilization for quite some time. So tell me, you've met so many inspirational and motivational people. How have you, Zephin, how have you changed?
I've changed in every way imaginable. I mean, I want to be here. You know, I want to live out every experience to the fullest. I'm certainly not that person at 13 years old who didn't want to be here, who was thinking that, you know, there was no more reasons left. But I think that my awareness is huge. I mean, I am so alert down to the point where not only do I know where I am in physical space, but I'm conscious of other people and their conversations in the room. I'm conscious of when an opportunity presents it to me and being able to know right on the spot whether or not I should take it and just grab onto it and run with it. And, you know, going from that scared person who worked a job and felt that he had to live out this script that was just passed down to him, you know, just live your way, live out this script that everyone else lives by. And now I'm this person who goes totally against the grain, who just said, screw it, let's see how far we can go with this and how awesome it can be. Build a successful business, find what you're passionate about and just do it and just go for it. And never question or look back or apologize for who you are, never apologize for who you've become, and just take it all in. I mean, I don't know. If you interviewed 150 people that had truly mastered the one thing that you wanted in life, wouldn't you learn everything you need? I mean, maybe not everything, but like...
Oh, you pulled a fair amount of knowledge from all of them.
Right. I mean, there's still going to be lessons for you to learn on your own. This is not something where it's like they give you everything on a silver platter. But like, I don't know about you, but like I've met people who, you know, have given up everything that they possessed to travel the world, to experience cultures, to go to the Galapagos, to, you know, there's one family that I interviewed on my podcast. They got a boat and just rode it around the world. You know, there's other people who have broken world records that were never seeming to be humanly possible before. And now that I've seen 150 or more, probably more. It's probably closer to 200 because we interviewed 40 some in that summer, in that summer series that we did. Like, you know, 200 people later, I feel like nothing is impossible anymore. Like, everyone has showed me how possible it is for you to do something that never seemed possible before. And so it's really comes down to, like, how far do you want to take it? It's your life and it's your opportunity to take it as far as you want. And so, you know, if today were your last day, if tomorrow were your last day, why aren't you living in that manner? You know, if you want to be that person that's breaking that world record that no one's ever done before, why are you not spending every waking second right now working towards that? Because if you died tomorrow, then they would know that you were working so hard on the one thing that you wanted to accomplish more than anything else. And if you accomplished it and then you died the next day, then you're forever remembered as the person that worked so hard for that one thing that they wanted and they did it. As opposed to, if you're not spending your time working towards that thing, then what are you really here for? Like, we're not here to just Netflix and chill and give up on our dream just because, you know, our parents didn't believe in us enough. We're not here to, you know, not do the one thing that we always wanted to do just because we're a little bit afraid. Like, it was a trip to California. I couldn't tell you at that time that, you know, I'm going to go to California and then I'm going to become this number one podcaster and then I'm going to be a number one bestselling author and then this is going to happen. That's, I can't tell you that. But looking back, I can tell you, had I not had the guts to take that leap, to make that decision and just say, you know what, the one thing that I've always wanted to do was go to California and I never did it, I should go do that. If I never had the guts to go and do that, I can tell you that I wouldn't be here where I am today. I'd be live. I'd probably be a lot more boring. And so to me, like, it means the world to show how much I've changed, you know, as a human being in every aspect of my life, physically, emotionally, mentally, financially, entrepreneurially. Like, I think, like, every piece of my life, my relationships are better than ever. And, you know, I attribute a lot of that to learning from other people's failures, to hearing their stories and hearing, you know, what they told themselves when they thought they were going to fail or when they were scared or when someone didn't believe in them. And also just kind of seeing how far they could set that bar out for themselves, you know, really just being able to see how they could set that crazy big goal that they want and just know, you know, increasing your own awareness and know that you could set the bar that much higher too. And I have to throw in there that something big that I learned from when I was at that conference where Pat Flynn spoke was, he was like, I want everybody, we were all sitting in our seats, and he was like, I want everybody to put your hand up as high as you can. You know, everyone raises their hand up. And then he says, all right, I want you guys to put it up even higher. And he's on stage standing, so he just kind of like goes up on his tippy toes. But of course, every person in their chair kind of raises up a little bit off the chair. And it's like, see, I told you to go as high as you could go. And then I told you to go further. And all of you could go further. Of course, they came up off their chair. But the point is, like, you can always, there's always more in the tank.
Right.
You know, I even learned that, like, being a rower and just practicing for some of the races we've been in is like, you're 3/4 of the way through the race and your body wants to give out. There's always more in the tank.
And I'm convinced that nothing happens to us by accident, that we direct the movie from the inside out. And I know for certain that our brains are magnets, and we attract what we are. And I don't think we attract what we want, we attract what we are.
So you decided to call this podcast episode The Last Podcast. If I were to ask you, what do you want to leave behind on this earth? What is it that you've learned from traveling the world, meeting people who have done all these things? I mean, what is the secret to life?
You know, the secret of life came to me when I was working with one of my mentors, Simon Smart. I went through his Warrior Protocol training, and after one of the best weekends of my entire life, we were in a meditation session. And I decided to pull out a piece of paper and write down, be proud of here. And I really think that that's it. Be here, not in the future, not in the past. You know, be proud of where you are right now, because if where you are right now is under a roof, sheltered from the weather, with, you know, a full belly, a few bucks in your wallet, and the ability to spend time with friends and family, then you have made it further than 90% of the people on this earth. And that's it. Be proud of right here, right now.
There you have it. The Last Podcast.